is in session. I'm going to explain what we're going to be doing for the next 2.5 days because we have a number of bills that we're trying to accommodate everyone that wishes to speak at the public hearings, as well as accommodate our time requirements. This morning we will hear 4 bills. The first 2 blocks of bills will be House Bill 2743 and 2749. The way we will proceed on each block of bills is that a representative from the Oregon Fairness Litigation Project and a representative from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association will each have 5 minutes per block to explain the bills, and then we'll proceed into a public testimony. We have 2 blocks of bills scheduled this morning, a total of 4 bills. Should we be fortunate enough to economize some of our time and could get out of here earlier this morning than anticipated, I might want to open up the afternoon block of hearings to accommodate those witnesses who are here until we have to go to floor session at approximately 11 o'clock. To accommodate Senator Atkins, I'll call him first as a witness and open a public hearing on House Bill 2743 and 2749. Senator?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, State Senator for Southern Oregon. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for getting to me. I just thought what I would do at the beginning of this is give you a brief first thanks and also overview of my involvement with this, and then allow you to get to your hearing as quick as possible. I've been involved in this issue now for about a year and a half, and have introduced 9 measures over on the Senate side, most of which you will hear in your committee over the next 2 days. So, first of all, thank you, Mr. Chair, for having such a judicious committee and hearing these things in blocks. I think there's some fantastic arguments that need to be expressed here before you today, and I thank you and thank the committee for taking a long look at them. I think one of the things that I have learned, Mr. Chair, in the last year and a half is that the legal profession blames the insurance profession, and the insurance profession blames the legal profession in the end. Oregonians have to pay a lot of money. I think that's where you start to get things like binding arbitration, attorney's fees, immunity for charitable organizations, hopefully some reforms on class actions, reforms certainly against frivolous lawsuits that we see so many times, especially in small business. And you'll see a whole list of these things come before you today and tomorrow. So I just wanted to say thank you. It's been a long time putting some of these together, and I think Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I hope you'll find that many of these are coming, I hope, from the middle. I think you can certainly see extremes on all sides when you're looking at any kind of change to the law where there's money involved. But it has been my interest to find reasonable reform that would actually protect people. Certainly we've seen cases in which, especially on the insurance / legal world, where small employers in Oregon just can't afford it anymore. I have a whole other list of bills in the Senate side that address 4 or 5 businesses in my districts that have gone out on some of these issues, gone out of business. I apologize for my voice and for being under the weather and for being a little bit scattered this morning, but I think that these bills are certainly very much connected to the recovery of our economy, very much connected to our ability to do business in this state, and very much connected to our ability to attract other businesses to Oregon. So, Mr. Chair, I told you I'd just give you 2 minutes, and it would mostly be around thanking you and the committee, and I think my 2 minutes is up. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. We have any questions for the committee to Senator Atkins? If not, you're excused.
Thank you.
Well.
Thank you very much.
I will have counsel explain the 2 bills which are before us, House Bill 2743 and 2749. Counsel?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2743 provides immunity from civil liability in 3 different situations. First, the bill provides that a civil action may not be brought against any individual or company by reason of the sale or prescription of a drug or medical device that was approved by the FDA and is in compliance with manufacturing and label regulations. Second, the bill provides immunity from civil liability to any individual or company by reason of use if the individual bringing the claim is suffering from a known and disclosed side effect of the drug. Third, the bill provides immunity from civil liability to a pharmacist by reason of preparing or selling the drug or medical device if the preparation or sale is done pursuant to a prescription issued by a physician or health care provider.
Thank you, counsel. I think at this time we'll have a representative from the Oregon Fairness Litigation Project come forward and representative from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And please come up, introduce yourself for the record, and give us a brief overview on the two bills which are before us. Mr. Mannix?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney from Salem, and I'm the project manager for the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project, which is an organization dedicated to improving the fairness of the civil litigation system. House Bill 2743 is one of several bills that we support in an effort to improve Oregon's civil justice system. It's designed to modernize the tort system for the state of Oregon in the context of drugs and medical devices, which go through a very complicated, time-consuming, careful, and expensive, as well as, I'll say, extensive process for review and for certification by the FDA. And the intention of the federal process is to protect medical consumers within the United States. It's a process which is not perfect, but which is, as a regulatory scheme, one of the most dynamic and successful systems that we have set up in the United States. It is something along the lines of a comprehensive process that never existed, say, in 1859 when the Oregon Constitution was established. That is, we were not used to having this kind of regulatory intervention that was available to protect consumers. In this bill, we take a look at the modern regulatory process and say that if we act as citizens involved in this process in reliance on that federal regulatory process and meet the standards of that process, then we've done our job. And if there is to be changes in those standards, if there are to be any kinds of liability applied outside of that system, it should be for someone who operated outside of the system. But for those who operate within the system should be protected because of their compliance with that regulatory system. Now, as I understood it earlier, I was supposed to speak to two bills, but it sounds like I should just speak to that one bill and pause. So what I will do is simply address the background issue as to what I will call the Pharmaceuticals and Medical Devices Bill, and say that the way we presented this, we were trying to parallel trends in the legislation in a variety of states around the United States. We are also trying to update our product liability law in this context because, as some of the background information we've provided to the committee demonstrates, that is really 40 years out of date. Other states have modernized their product liability law. This does it in regard to drugs and medical devices. We also need to recognize that medicines, pharmaceuticals, are a much greater part of the health care of Oregonians than they were 40 years ago. That is why we are confronted with so many issues about the expense in the health care system relating to drugs or pharmaceuticals. The good news is that we've had great success in prevention of illness, and we've had great success in recovery from illness as a result of the dynamic expansion of our scientific capability to apply scientific knowledge through medicine. And this has been a wonderful thing. It's also a very expensive process, but as that process has gone forward, the federal government has exercised its authority to properly regulate this process. I didn't say perfectly, because there's no such thing as perfection in government regulation, but properly regulate the process so that we can protect consumers. This is a process then that we should turn to, we should identify with, and we should rely upon to protect our consumers, and we should say that those who are good enough to have gone through this process should receive the protections offered by this legislation. Thank you.
Did you want to relate to the second bill?
If you wish, Mr. Chairman, I will.
Yeah, because we're hearing him in blocks, so to economize time, why don't you tell us?
I'll be glad to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I should also mention that we have made 25 copies available to the public of information packets, which we've submitted to all of the committee members, with additional five copies for committee staff, which concludes talking points on all the bills that are up for the next couple of days, as well as some background information and a discussion of tort reform generally. So that information packet, I hope, would be made part of the record for this legislation, as it is information we've presented to the committee on all the bills. And I thank you for that opportunity. The second bill that's up is 2749, sponsored by Representative Flores. And this bill is a little unusual because it combines two concepts, sovereign immunity and charitable immunity. Sovereign immunity is still well recognized in Oregon as the immunity of government against being sued. I won't give you the 30-minute speech about the history of sovereign immunity. It went back to the novel concept that the king can do no wrong. We understand these days that the king can do wrong, government can do wrong, but the tradition in the common law and the tradition in the United States was that you could not sue government because government now represents the people, and any action that you take against the people ought to be through the political process, not through the legal process. A compromise has been achieved over the years where we have what we call limited sovereign immunity. The state of Oregon has the Oregon Tort Claims Act, and we by statute have allowed lawsuits against the state. We need to understand that you could abolish any opportunity to sue the state, but we've moved in the other direction. And over the years, we've expanded the liability of the state and other government institutions to $300,000. And we've said, yes, if you fulfill the standards of the Oregon Tort Claims Act, we will allow you to have, in effect, an opportunity to break through the sovereign immunity shield. That's one piece of the law. The question is, what is government action? How far do we go in protecting organizations that are doing things that, say, 20 or 30 years ago may have been done largely or exclusively by government? What about organizations that are now working with government today receiving grants? The original bill that you have in front of you talks about nonprofit corporations, but as I have pointed out to the chair of the full committee and the chair of the subcommittee and other members, we had proposed amendments. I'm still checking to see if they've been finalized. We spoke to Legislative Council last week about this, and I provided the chair of this committee with a copy of a memo where we really limit the nonprofits who would be eligible for protection under this bill, which would bring nonprofits under the Oregon Tort Claims Act, to nonprofit corporations which are providing special community services. Community services involving operations such as food banks, soup kitchens, rent and utility assistance for the poor, transportation assistance for the poor, services to victims of crime, community or youth athletics, alcohol or drug treatment programs, children's services, education, affordable housing, job training, employment services, women's crisis centers, family centers, homeless outreach programs, foster care, homes for pregnant mothers and for mothers of young children, and services to children and families. In the last 30 years, these social services networks have moved extensively into nonprofit operations in the community and moving away from direct government control. Now, how can we make the legal argument that this is a good thing to do or a legitimate thing to do? You shift to the common law concept of charitable immunity. When Oregon was established as a state and the Constitution went into effect in 1859, the doctrine of charitable immunity was a legitimate doctrine which existed in parts of the United States. It existed for a while. It had existed for a while in the United Kingdom and then was set aside. In the state of Oregon, from 1912 until 1963, by Supreme Court decision, they interpreted the law to allow charitable immunity in Oregon. And we provided the background research on that. As of 1963, the Supreme Court finally said, well, the legislature has never enacted this, and since we just did it as a matter of policy, we'll take a step back, we'll undo the charitable immunity because the legislature never adopted it, and so we'll set it aside. All done by judicial decision-making under the same Oregon Constitution that we're talking about today. We are not asking this committee or this legislature to adopt charitable immunity across the board, but we do think a concept of limited charitable immunity as to these special nonprofit organizations that I've mentioned, when you combine it with the sovereign immunity concept, which is what this bill does, is a legitimate way to protect nonprofits who provide these important services from extraordinary expenses which they face in litigation and which they face in terms of the insurance market, and you'll hear some other testimony about that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Fine. You're right on with 5 minutes. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Lane. I am a representative from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and will be meeting with you, I guess, briefly over the next 2.5 days as we go through these bills. I am going to leave most of the opposition to the individual witnesses that will speak to each of the bills as the committee takes them up. I want to make a couple of brief comments regarding the package overall, what the effect is going to be, and then speak briefly to 2743 and 2749. The bills as a package from top to bottom are basically bills that are going to restrict access to justice, eliminate rights and remedies that injured Oregonians have right now under existing law, and make it more costly, more expensive, and more time-consuming to get any cases resolved. As a package, all of the bills should be we oppose all of the bills and would make that recommendation to the committee. Some of the members here were present in 2003 when I think we had 2.5 or 3 days worth of hearings in that session. Many of these bills were considered at that time, and Chair Max Williams didn't move any of the bills forward. In fact, he took a look at how we can actually do things to improve Oregonians, and Representative McPherson, I know, was very involved in a couple of good pieces of legislation that did move forward. Representative Max Williams and many of the committee members at that time also worked diligently with a lot of the stakeholders in doing things that had a positive impact on all Oregonians involved in the tort system. None of these bills are anywhere near those positive pieces of legislation that came out of the 2003 session. 2743 is a free pass for pharmaceutical companies, pharmacists, anybody that's involved in the selling or distribution of drugs. We will have for the committee, I don't have the copies right now, New York Times article of April 1, 2005, where the FDA itself criticizes the oversight of medical device makers for failing to do the regulatory requirements and the testing and the studies associated with getting drugs to the marketplace. And I think all of the committee members are familiar now with the number of drugs that have gone through the regulatory process and found to, in fact, injure or kill Oregonians. The bill speaks to nothing about information learned, what's called post-FDA approval, and gives a blanket immunity for those manufacturers that sell drugs if they participate in the FDA process, which is required. 2749, any way you cut it, is an extension of the limited tort claims recovery, $100,000, to what's presently identified as any 501c3 corporation in the state. I obtained information from the Corporation Commission and found that there's approximately 12,000 501c3 corporations presently operated in Oregon. Of those, a number are medical providers, hospitals, and for-profit operations that have no business having tort claim immunity. And in fact, Oregonians have rejected such an immunity extended to those providers twice in this state. I understand that there's going to be some amendments, and I'll gladly take a look at the amendments as they come out, but extending what is limited sovereign immunity, the procedural requirements, the damage limitations to entities that are not governmental entities is the wrong way that to protect Oregonians. And as we go through, I'll be happy to address each of the other bills. And that's less than 5 minutes. Thank you, members of the committee.
You did well. Thank you. Thank you very much for the overview. And while you're here, I'm going to open it up to questions from the committee to each of you. Committee members have questions? Yes, Representative McPherson.
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Mannix with respect to House Bill 2743, which, as I read it, would eliminate liability for the manufacturer of prescription drugs as long as the risks or side effects are disclosed to the FDA in the approval process. Now, what I'm not particularly conversant with medical matters. I am aware that a lot of the concerns about drugs and devices is that not that they don't fail to do what they're intended to do, but that they do other things that are harmful to the patient or alleged to be harmful. And given this kind of scheme, if this were enacted, what would happen to the flow of information to prescribing physicians and to patients about those risks if the manufacturer of the drug or device has no obligation after the approval process is done? Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I think that's a very good question, and actually, should you want to move forward with this bill, I think it needs to be revised. There are some models from some other states where successful legislation has gone through that addresses the issue in more particularity. And as to your question, it's important to make sure that the flow of information goes beyond the FDA, that it goes to the medical providers, and that it goes on to the ultimate consumers, that that information needs to be made available as part of this process. And I think it's a legitimate issue to be addressed in amendments to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions for the committee? I have a couple of questions to each of you. Referring first to House Bill 2743, which apparently gives certain grants of civil immunity, I'm wondering if any of you have considered the implications of this, of the constitutionality of this concept under Article 1, Section 10 of the Oregon Constitution, mm-hmm. Remedies Clause, and the right to jury trial. Could each of you express yourself on that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin Mannix, I guess I'm pretty well introduced anyway for purposes of this this committee today. The whole question of in effect, access to the courts is one that is in a gray area right now, I would argue, in terms of what the Supreme Court has said. And they've danced a little bit on this issue because some of their early decisions were, I think, presented pretty much in black and white, and as time has passed, they've backed away a bit because trying to define what you could do in 1859 in terms of access to the courts is actually a two-edged sword. There were a number of things that never existed as a right in 1859 that are recognized generally by the public today. There are other things that were seen as a right in terms of access to the courts, but nobody actually accessed the courts. And the reality is that in 1859, the advance of science was so limited in the area of medicine that nothing in terms of the whole scheme that we have today for the creation of medication and the creation of pharmaceuticals or medical devices, nothing in the context of the regulatory scheme, all of the dynamic changes that have occurred, was contemplated. What this bill does is it recognizes the advances of science and the advancement of the regulatory scheme while still saying that you're provided with your opportunity to challenge a provider, but it redefines, in effect, what negligence is all about. It doesn't say that you can't allege negligence, but it redefines negligence to say that if you have met these extraordinary regulatory requirements, you have not done something that is wrong where you can have a cause of action. You're going to have to show that someone went outside of these parameters.
Thank you. Mr. Lane?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I respectfully disagree with my colleague. I think the Supreme Court has actually made it pretty clear that this bill, 2743, would not survive constitutional scrutiny under some of the cases like Smothers setting out the analysis for remedies. Mr. Mannix is correct. You would look at the state of the law in 1859. I think you would find historically that the right to sue a seller of a drug or a manufacturer of a drug, albeit it was a more simple time, less complicated drugs, but that right existed, and this bill would take that right and remedy away from Oregonians. I'd also note that the bill repeals ORS 30.927, which is a punitive damage remedy against pharmaceutical companies, which also allows the imposition of punitive damages if the manufacturer fails to disclose during the FDA process vital information. And 2743 removes that out and does not include it in the language as submitted today.
Thank you.
May I respond to that last point?
All right, you may briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Oregon Supreme Court has specifically ruled that exemplary damages, as they were then known, or punitive damages, are not part of the right to access to courts.
Thank you for that. Stay here. I got a couple more questions, all right? referring to House Bill 2749, if you grant to these nonprofit organizations a form of sovereign immunity, and you deem them as public agencies in the bill, doesn't that open them up to public record scrutiny and the open meeting laws which apply to public agencies?
Mr. Chairman, I assume you're starting with me, so I'll go ahead. First of all, if I may, I'd like to announce that I have just received a copy of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2749, which when I'm done here, I'll provide to staff so they can be copied for the benefit of the public as well as the benefit of the committee members, and it goes through the limitations I discussed in my earlier testimony. We will need to address that issue as to public bodies in terms of definitions, because there will be some activities of those organizations that should be subject to public scrutiny if they want to receive this kind of protection. One of the things you'll see in the amendments is a discussion of, for instance, how much they pay some of their top-level staff, trying to, although that may not have ended up in these amendments, I haven't yet had a chance to read them, but the idea of saying how far do you get to go and still call yourself a nonprofit carrying on activities in the community that are community service activities if you're paying somebody an extraordinary amount of money to run the organization. We will need to address that issue as to whether or not there is going to be limited access or full access to records, and you could impose a requirement that the public records law will apply if the organization wants to claim this kind of protection. I say could. I am also of the opinion you can make a decision to go halfway or to say no, despite that we're going to define them as not being public entities for other purposes, because we're combining two concepts here, not just sovereign immunity, but charitable immunity. And this is, in effect, also a limited charitable immunity piece of legislation.
Thank you. Mr. Lane, do you want to respond?
Mr. Chairman, again, without taking a look at the dash ones and seeing where we're tailored down to, I would say that the 501c3s in the original bill, if one extended it to the immunity afforded to the governmental agencies, should come with it the disclosure requirements of the public records law and the open meeting laws. Whether an organization could opt in or opt out, I'm not quite sure I understand that distinction. But if the bill was extended or the grant of sovereign immunity was granted to any entity, one would think that the public records and public hearing laws would apply to those.
Thank you very much. And then a question to Mr. Mannix. I assume that if the bill passed and these non-profit corporations were within the Oregon Tort Claims Act, that then they would be defended by the state of Oregon in the event of lawsuits. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that process might be administered by the by BASS. Have you determined whether the public agency wants this responsibility and what the cost may be to the nonprofits to take advantage of the Oregon Tort Claims Act for defense purposes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I haven't read the amendments yet. And by the way, now I have 25 copies, which I can provide to the staff. I asked legislative counsel in this process to make it clear that the Attorney General does not represent them, and that there's a practical reason, a philosophical reason. The practical reason is that has a fiscal impact, and this bill would end up in Ways and Means, and it'll never come back. Philosophically, I don't think it's good for the Attorney General to be so intermingled with these organizations and their operations and having to defend them, when in so many other aspects of their operations, they are not really subject to government control other than through the grants process. So the bill should specifically provide that the Attorney General does not defend them.
And then what happens? Who would represent these groups?
They would be represented by their own counsel.
And charge back their fees to whom?
No, they would incur their legal defense costs on their own and have to pay them. They're being given the protection of the Tort Claims Act, but they're not being given the benefit of government administration or defense.
So they have private insurance, but the limitations of the Tort Claims Act for damage awards.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Fine. Mr. Lane, you want to respond?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that seems to put those charitable corporations in a terribly awkward position. On the one hand, they're being provided the limitations to $100,000 worth of non-economic damages associated with the sovereign immunity statute, or the tort claims statute, but they're not getting the defense from the department. It also raises a question in my mind of who's paying the $100,000? Is that not also covered through the state's risk fund, just like any other governmental agency that pays those damages presently? And if they're not getting a defense, then they're having to go to the private marketplace to purchase insurance anyway, which would cover liability and the cost of defense associated with any claim, or it's coming out of the individual corporation's pocket to provide a defense in the face of a legitimate claim. So it's sort of the worst of both worlds, if you will, for the charitable corporation.
Fine, thank you. Further questions from the committee?
Actually, yes, I do have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this question's for you, Mr. Lane. I heard you say that House Bill 2743 was a free pass to pharmaceuticals and those selling them. I'm just wondering if should a pharmacist be sued for filling for a prescription if that prescription is found later to we'll just take, for example, some of these painkillers that are out there that they're discussing. If should they be held liable for filling a prescription that a doctor has after they have prescribed it?
Representative Thatcher, members of the committee, each set of facts would have to be examined separately. What 2743 does is it provides a blanket immunity under Section 2 for the pharmacists, with the caveat, I believe, that there's a negligence claim could be asserted if the prescription was filled improperly or by mistake. So the free pass reaches the manufacturer. Free pass, I guess, reaches the manufacturer. Would probably stop at the pharmacist who is following the prescription diagnosis of an individual pharmacist, except that presently, if he is aware that an individual is going to be harmed by that, there may be an obligation on the pharmacist to actually find out a little bit more about whether this drug is a proper drug, given what may be out there in the body of work at this time. Vioxx would be an example presently. So I'd have to look at each one of the facts associated with any case, but this bill does provide an absolute bar to suing the pharmacist except for a mishandling of a prescribed drug.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. Would you think it would be fair under section, subsection 2, section 1, that adding a pharmacist, that a civil action may be brought against a health practitioner if there was reasonable, there was no reasonable health practitioner that would sell that drug or medical device? Are you suggesting that perhaps adding a pharmacist in there, if they should have the same type of knowledge, would be an acceptable amendment to you?
Representative Thatcher, members of the committee, my objection to 2743 is the entire extending to anybody the immunity that may come through the FDA process. So if it reaches anybody that just merely because you hold up a piece of paper that says it has passed through the regulatory process, you cannot be sued. I object to that because of the holes in that system, and it flies in the face of existing law.
She's bringing them right back.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Okay.
Thank you. Further questions then of the committee of these two witnesses, Representative McPherson.
Mr. Mannix, with respect to 2749, I was intrigued by the interchange you had with the chair. Is there any precedent, any past experience with extending the Tort Claims Act limitations and opportunities that it creates for litigants outside of governmental organizations, so that in effect an organization that is contracting with government but is buying private insurance and hiring its own counsel is then operating in a Tort Claims Act environment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, yes and no. Many states have recognized the doctrine not only of sovereign immunity but of charitable immunity at various times over the last couple of hundred years. There is not precedent for combining the two, but then Oregon is always unique in being willing to be a leader in a dynamic way in terms of coming up with new ways to solve problems. The problem here is if we reestablish a limited charitable immunity, which we could through separate legislation, it gets complicated. It gets complicated in terms of what process you want to use, what the case law would be about the procedures. The beauty of the Oregon Tort Claims Act is that it already provides you with a box of procedures and concepts that you can use, and you can step into that box. But as the chairman indicated in his questions, we need to cover some other policy issues. What about representation by the Attorney General? No, we're not trying to do that. What about the actual payment of the judgment after a successful litigation? No, the nonprofit should be responsible for that. In essence, they are asking to step into the box for limited purposes, that is, to have a type of charitable immunity, but the rationale is also a combination of sovereign immunity because of the types of organizations and activities as through the amendments that are going to be covered by this bill. So you come at it from two perspectives, sovereign immunity over here, charitable immunity over here. They intersect with this limited immunity under the Tort Claims Act. And the only reason we're proposing to use the Tort Claims Act is because it's an existing recognized vehicle. It's got four doors on it. It's got an engine. We know how it runs, and we can decide where you want the passenger to sit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Representative Garrard.
Mr. Lane, your main objection to 2743 was based on FDA approval of products because you say there's holes in the process. Could you give the committee an example of the kind of hole you're talking about?
Representative Garrard, members of the committee, by specific example, I am not familiar, but I can provide a witness that has a little bit more experience with litigation associated with FDA-approved pharmaceuticals. In fact, it may be coming up in this very next presentation that we'll hear from. But I can probably repeat what representatives are already familiar with, that we have at times heard about heart valves that in fact were flawed from the design and information was not shared with the FDA and it was subject to approval, and struts that had inadequate wells broke and ended up killing and injuring a number of individuals, including in Oregon, that had that. Pacemakers, defibrillators, those types of medical devices have over time shown that either information was held from the FDA during the process or studies was not actually disclosed during the FDA process. I believe right now, although I'm not from experience, can explain to you the details, but the COX-3 inhibitors that we've heard so much about, Bextra, Vioxx, there may have been not peer-reviewed literature, scientific tests done on test subjects, that information was not disclosed to the FDA. Some of it was deliberately buried. Some of it was done offshore in other countries and not disclosed to the FDA. So I think there is a number of examples that could be shown that the FDA process is not working all the time to protect consumers.
Any follow-up? Okay. Further questions of this panel? Representative Thatcher.
One more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In subsection 3, it talks about a person can't bring a suit if the risk or side effect was fully disclosed by the manufacturer of the drug to the FDA. Now, you're talking about instances where they did not disclose the side effects fully to the FDA, and I don't see that they would be given immunity in this bill.
Representative Thatcher, members of the committee, I think that is exactly what I'm talking about inside that section. Let's say that you do test studies on 100 people, and you say in 99% of the time, a heart attack is going to result from the use of that particular drug. And yet you disclose the risk of a heart attack in a smaller percentage or in a not specific explanation of how often, how frequent, the type of people subject to. One could argue that the immunity does apply because the risk of a heart attack has been disclosed, and yet the full details either have not been presented to the FDA or the high rate or significance to a certain class of individuals was actually known.
May I counter, Mr. Chairman?
You may.
The word fully is in front of disclosed. And so I think that takes care of everything. If it's not fully disclosed, it's not disclosed. And certainly there may be some other technical improvements to the language here, and I think Representative McPherson made a very good point about what about disclosure to the consumer? What about disclosure to the medical provider who prescribes the medication? And I think those are very legitimate issues. But the word fully is there.
Okay. Further questions then from the committee? Hearing none, we'll excuse you at this time. And thank you for your testimony. It's been very informative. I want to inform the rest of you kind of where we are witness-wise and time-wise. We've allocated until 10 o'clock to these two bills, and the next two we've allocated up to 10:45. I certainly anticipate we may run over a little bit because the first two bills this morning that we are hearing now are probably the most complicated, most controversial. I think we'll be able to pick up some time as we proceed to the next two and a half days. I just want to keep you aware of our time requirements. I have about nine witnesses remaining on the first two bills that are slated for 8:30 to 10. Once again, we will accommodate you by going over if that's necessary. I'm going to call the several groups up, starting with the proponents of House Bill 2743, and in that respect, I will call Mr. Gardner, Mr. Crewe, Mr. Burns.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. PhRMA represents the majority of the prescription drug manufacturers in the United States. You have my written testimony in support of House Bill 2743. I'm not going to go through that verbatim, and I think Mr. Mannix has described the bill quite accurately, and I would also concur with his statement that if you do decide to work the bill, it probably should have some amendments that address the post-approval setting, as Representative McPherson alluded to in his discussion and questioning. I want to make just two basic points. First, in 1987, the legislature did enact the counterpart to this kind of government standards defense in the context of punitive damages, and that is in the law right now. There is an FDA defense for prescription and non-prescription drugs with regard to punitive damages. Now, I recognize that extending that into the non-punitive area raises many additional issues, but one of them that it poses is the issue of cost, because the extraordinarily volatile product liability climate that exists in the United States translates inevitably into product cost and the elevation of product cost. That is simply one of the factors that you need to consider and balance when you are deciding to what degree to impose product liability exposure on a class of products that I think all of us recognize are essential to health and well-being. I think I'll just leave it at that leave it with you with my written testimony.
Thank you. I'm going to have the panel fully testify and then open it up for questions.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Tom Burns with GlaxoSmithKline. We're the second largest pharmaceutical company. We are here in support. You have our written testimony. I thought, based on the conversation from previous witnesses, I would just give you an example of one of the issues that faced our company. We are a maker of half of the Fen-Phen products. And I use the word products because, as you recall, this was a combination of drugs that was prescribed for people who wished to chose to lose weight. It was never a drug Fen-Phen. It was two individual drugs with two different prescriptions. We made half of it. We were not the half that was causing the problem. Yet we were bombarded with lawsuits over that drug that we had to defend ourselves for simply because we were tied into something from a product that was used off-label and inappropriately. And we believe that this bill will go a long ways towards allowing us to say, wait a minute, time out, our product, it was done by FDA rule, the doctors prescribed it appropriately, the pharmacist filled it appropriately, and the fact that someone chose to use it with another product is not our responsibility. And other than that, I stand on our testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Crewe. I'm an attorney in Portland, and we represent the Oregon Medical Association. To be clear on this bill, if it is to go forward, we do believe it will require some amendment relative to the issue of subsequent knowledge and disclosure of that to the public, and more importantly, the use of drugs if a physician or other provider were to know that they, in fact, had been determined not to be safe for their intended use. But that said, the OMA has been dedicating a great deal of effort over the last several years to try to cut down what we determine or call frivolous litigation. Now, I'm not suggesting that a patient that's been injured by a drug or device and a claim on that is frivolous, but put yourself in the position of the physician who relies entirely upon the FDA process and what that involves as between the manufacturer and the federal government, and they're prescribing a drug on label or a device on label and using it appropriately for the purposes intended, and they get drug into this litigation. And we believe that the bill would, in fact, resolve that issue, and if there is a question about liability as between the manufacturer and the consumer, that's where it should lie, not with the prescribing physician. They basically got caught in the middle. And again, we're trying to cut down on needless litigation, which drives up the cost of insurance, malpractice insurance, which also affects access to medical care in this state. And that's really our position on the bill. If it does move forward, it needs to be amended, but it's a good bill if it is properly amended.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have questions from the committee? I guess well done. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have three more witnesses on House Bill 2743, all of whom indicate that they are against the bill, and I'll call them in a separate panel. Nancy Cochran, looks like Ellen Sternfeld, and Maribeth Healy. Are you here? Please come forward. You may testify in any order you wish. Someone has to go first, so state your name for the record, please.
Thank you for having me here. I'm a little nervous, so bear with me.
Okay. You might help us by speaking a little more loudly.
Okay.
All right, and then we'll see how it goes.
Okay. I strongly oppose this bill because it would let the big drug companies escape responsibility for marketing dangerous products.
Excuse me, I don't think you gave us your name, and I may have missed
sorry.
That.
It's Nancy Cochran.
Thank you.
Thank you. These products hurt or kill people. I believe this bill is unconscionable, designed to benefit large drug companies at the expense of Oregon's citizens. I speak as one who has been harmed by a drug that was placed on the market, even though it was extremely harmful. I'm here today because I feel so strongly about this matter. It's difficult for me to speak about these personal things in front of you all, but I want to tell my story for the sake of others who may find themselves harmed, as I have been. For 9.5 months in 1996 and 1997, I took the diet drug Redux, which my doctor prescribed for weight loss. This drug was only on the market for about a year, and then it was pulled off the market because it causes severe lung and heart damage. The drug company knew that the Redux caused problems, but it downplayed the dangers and marketed it anyway. During the year that it was on the market, it made vast sums of money at the expense of people like me. As a result of taking this deadly drug, I have heart damage and a lung disease called primary pulmonary hypertension. This is a rare disease that is being seen more and more in people who took Redux and other diet drugs such as Fen-Phen. The disease is progressive and ultimately fatal. Pulmonary hypertension starts when the small vessels that supply blood to the lungs constrict. It has been more difficult for the blood to get through to the lungs, and the heart must pump harder to overcome the resistance. As time passes, scarring of the blood vessels makes them stiffer and thicker, and some may be completely blocked. The extra stress causes the heart to enlarge and become less flexible. Less and less blood is able to flow out of the heart, through the lungs, and into the body, and more symptoms start to show. Eventually, the heart and lungs fail, resulting in death. There is no cure for this disease, and all the doctors can do is to try to slow the progression. Until just a few years ago, a person with this disease was expected to die within a year after diagnosis. There are some new medications that in some cases can prolong a person's life beyond that. The doctors are unable to predict how fast my disease will progress or how much longer I can expect to live. At present, I take four different medications for this condition, which cost about $100 per month. And as the disease progresses, I am told that I will most likely need to be put on a more powerful drug, which costs $30,000 per year, which I cannot afford. This damage to my health has affected my life and activities in countless ways, pervading nearly all areas of my life. I suffer from severe fatigue, shortness of breath, chest pains, ankle swelling, and dizziness and faintness at times. My most troublesome symptom is the fatigue. It prevents me from doing many of the things I could before. I can no longer take long walks, which curtails such activities as sightseeing and even shopping. Housework and everyday responsibilities are more burdensome and exhausting than before. Due to heart valve damage, I now must take antibiotics prior to every visit to the dentist, even just to have my teeth cleaned in case any bacteria should get into my bloodstream. I have to travel to Portland for at least 2 days every 6 months to have tests and to see the specialist who is treating me for this condition. He is a pulmonologist at Oregon Health and Science University. Usually the tests are an echocardiogram and an exercise tolerance test to measure my lung capacity. At some point, I will have to have another heart catheterization. This is just what it sounds like. They insert a catheter into the right ventricle of the heart to measure the blood pressure. This is obviously a risky procedure, and I dread having to have it done again. I am limited as to where I can live and where I can go due to the need to be where there is access to the medical specialists that I need. There are only a handful of doctors in the country who specialize in this condition. I resent this restriction on my freedom of choice and movement. I am unable to obtain long-term care insurance, so I'm faced with the probability of eventually needing nursing care with no insurance to help pay for it. I retired 5 years ago after a lifetime of employment. I was greatly looking forward to my retirement. Needless to say, this medical condition has put a damper on the quality of my hard-earned retirement. I took this drug to lose weight. Because of it, I will lose my life. Their drug will kill me, yet under this bill, the drug company would not be held accountable, and I would have no recourse. I can't imagine why anybody would propose a law that would allow this to happen. It seems to me like it would be giving the drug companies free rein to market anything they want to if they can get it past the FDA. And we all know that happens, as evidenced not only by the drug I took, but by the many others that have proven to be dangerous. I have a lawsuit pending against the drug company that marketed Redux. I hope to be compensated for being sold a deadly substance, a poison that will kill me. They need to pay for what they have done. Under the proposed law, I would have no recourse and no remedy for what has happened to me. Please don't take away the rights of others like me who may find themselves in similar situations. Oregonians have a constitutional right to have access to justice and to hold accountable those people or companies who harm us. don't weaken that ride. Don't let the big drug companies escape responsibility when they market products that harm and kill people. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Sternfield. I'm the attorney in charge of the Oregon Department of Justice Medicaid Fraud Unit. With me is Cheryl Pellegrini, who's the attorney in charge of the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Litigation Unit, and we're here in opposition to House Bill 2743. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about the impact that this litigation could have, or this statute could have, on the litigation that my unit does, and Ms. Pellegrini will talk then about the impact it could have on the litigation her unit does. Senator Atkinson mentioned in his comments this morning about the purpose for these bills to save Oregonians millions of dollars. I'd like to state that this bill would cost Oregonians and Oregonian programs millions of dollars. The Oregon Department of Justice Medicaid Fraud Control Unit has been a leader in national pharmaceutical litigation over the past 3 to 4 years. The allegations that we have pursued in civil litigation have brought back billions, and I do mean billions of dollars, to the Medicaid programs nationally and millions of dollars to the Oregon Medicaid program. The types of allegations we've pursued in civil litigation include pharmaceutical companies who manipulated AWP pricing, the average wholesale pricing upon which Medicaid pays for pharmaceutical products for its Medicaid recipients, improper marketing and promotion of drugs for off-label use, paying improper kickbacks and inducements to providers to allow them to get them to prescribe certain drugs and products, and importantly, failure to report such payments as required by the Federal Medicaid Drug Rebate Act so that the Oregon Medicaid program gets the benefit of the best price that's available for drugs and products. Just as one example, failure of Pfizer to report a $100,000 payment to an HMO in Louisiana to get that HMO to keep Lipitor as its preferred drug cost Medicaid programs $24.5 million in underpaid Medicaid drug rebates. And 3 years ago in civil litigation, my unit pursued Pfizer and obtained double damages for the Oregon Medicaid program as a result of this improper action. We've also pursued cases involving pharmaceutical companies who provide free products and samples to Oregon providers, but provide them the documentation to allow them to improperly bill those free products and samples to the Oregon Medicaid program. Last year, we participated in civil litigation against Abbott Labs for provision of free pumps that they provided along with certain enteral nutrition products. Our civil litigation brought back in excess of $500,000 to the Oregon Medicaid program as a result of the improper billing of those free samples. All of these types of cases would be prohibited and we would not be able to pursue them under House Bill 2743. In addition, I'd like to briefly address the concerns Representative McPherson and Representative Thatcher raised regarding Subsection 1.3. If you look at subsection 1 of the bill, it is a blanket prohibition. There can be no civil litigation pursued against a manufacturer or any individual by reason of the sale or marketing of sale or prescription of a drug or medical device. And the only exception is a very limited exception in subsection 2. If you think of this in terms of the Neurontin litigation that Oregon, both jointly the Consumer Protection Unit and my unit, pursued last year, Neurontin was marketed off-label by the pharmaceutical manufacturer and promoted for improper usage to a number of practitioners. Those practitioners relied on these improper marketing techniques, including falsified studies, to prescribe Neurontin for unapproved uses. If you consider subsection 2, a reasonable health practitioner might have relied on those improper studies to prescribe the drug. Because, therefore, the exception in subsection 2 is not met, section 1 would prevail and there could be no litigation regarding the sale or provision of this drug. The fact that it might fall in subsection 3 is irrelevant because subsection 1 says the only exception to the prohibition is if it fits in subsection 2. So the millions of dollars that were obtained, the total Neurontin settlement against Pfizer was in the area of $240 million. I last Monday provided the Medicaid agency $1.2 million in fines, penalties, and restitution from the Neurontin litigation. That would not have gone if this that would not have gone to the agency if this section, if this statute was in place.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, also with the Oregon Department of Justice. Just a few more examples following on what Ms. Sternfield has said. And again, it is the department's position that this bill as drafted is far too broad, and it is based on the inaccurate assumption that meeting the requirements of the FDA drug approval process inoculates the public against unlawful conduct by prescription drug manufacturers. And we have found that that is just not the case. Some more examples. It would prevent the Attorney General's office from bringing actions under state consumer protection laws against drug manufacturing companies for failure to disclose material information from studies conducted after a drug was approved. We've seen this time and time again. The Synthroid case was the first drug and that we pursued an action under this theory, and that was a case where the manufacturer failed to disclose that it had studies that showed that there was a generic equivalent to the more expensive branded drug that could have been marketed for much less to consumers. The Paxil case, which the New York Attorney General's office just brought, I believe they just settled with a drug manufacturer in that regard. In that case, the drug manufacturer knew and failed to disclose a significant increased risk of suicide among adolescents who were taking the drug. As a result, children died. There were cases where drug manufacturers subsequent to FDA approval engaged in misleading and deceptive direct-to-consumer advertisement, Zithromax. It's a treatment for a child's inner ear infection. The manufacturer of Zithromax falsely marketed that drug as being what's called a first-line treatment. That means that it is the first drug that parents should go to when their kids get a serious inner ear infection. In fact, the company knew, because it had studies showing, that Zithromax was no more effective than the generic equivalent amoxicillin, and in some cases, it was no more effective than no treatment at all. The consequence of this conduct has cost consumers millions and millions of dollars because they have not had access to accurate information that would allow them to make an informed choice about whether or not to purchase a branded drug or a generic drug. I'll give one more example. Submitting false information to the Patent and Trade Office to keep less expensive generic drugs off market. Two very recent settlements, Buspar, Taxol. Taxol is a cancer drug. Buspar is an antidepressant. In both of those cases, post-FDA approval, the drug manufacturer submitted false information to the Patent and Trade Office to unlawfully extend the patent on those drugs. The effect? To keep less expensive generics from entering the market and becoming available to consumers who depend on them, and Taxol for their lives. These cases all would be precluded under House Bill 2743. It would prevent the Attorney General from applying Oregon consumer protection laws to the benefit of Oregonians to address these cases where there have been unlawful and deceptive marketing, post-FDA approval of pharmaceuticals.
Thank you. I called three witnesses and got four. You're still welcome. We just need to know who you are.
Switch up a little bit. Good morning, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Healy. I'm the Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. Oregonians for Health Security is a coalitional organization of concerned citizens, individuals, business community, faith community, labor, and healthcare professionals who are united to advocate for increased access to quality, affordable, and secure healthcare. And through our work, we found that from small business owners to healthcare workers without health insurance, Oregonians are concerned about their own and their neighbors' healthcare troubles. And the other thing they're concerned about is the lack of accountability in the healthcare industry. And House Bill 2743 would give immunity to the pharmaceutical companies when patients are harmed. And proposals such as this just make me wonder, what problem are they trying to solve? The recent stories of medication being taken off the market because of adverse effects should give us pause when considering legislation that reduces accountability in this very profitable industry. Vioxx and most recently Bextra had been approved by the FDA and were still taken off the shelves. Patients who have taken these medications as prescribed are now having adverse effects, and this legislation would ask them to pay an even higher price, no recourse. There are many legislative proposals that answer the question, how will this help Oregonians? House Bill 2743 is not one of them. It removes accountability and gives companies that sell products that harm Oregonians a free ride. It applies to drugs and medical devices such as pacemakers and other products. It's a sweeping bill that does nothing to lower health care costs, which is the number one concern of Oregonians today, and it only helps the pharmaceutical companies. There are 780,000 Oregonians without any prescription drug coverage who are screaming for relief. This bill does nothing to give them relief or access the medications that they need. It just is relief for the pharmaceutical companies. And as public servants, I know your commitment to the public is tantamount, and we rely on you to hold corporate interests accountable for our health and safety. We need more accountability in the healthcare industry, not less, and I urge you not to pass this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Let me ask the committee if we have any questions. Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Your testimony, ladies, all seems to be attacking the drug companies. What are your feelings about the local pharmacists who fill the prescriptions, et cetera, that part of the bill?
I guess I have a couple of concerns, Representative Gerard, Mr. Chairman. I'm not sure that about the breadth of the statute. For example, would it impact a licensing action on behalf of the Oregon Board of Pharmacy if it finds that a pharmacist is getting multiple controlled substances prescriptions from multiple doctors for one patient? And is filling them when obviously, you know, by looking at the face of it, there appears to be either prescription shopping or inappropriate prescribing practices or drug-seeking behavior. Would the Oregon Board of Pharmacy be able to pursue a licensing action on behalf of a pharmacist in that sort of situation? I don't know. I don't see a definition of civil action, and I don't know if it would apply to administrative action or if an insurance company wanted to take a civil action against the pharmacist for doing the same thing. Again, the breadth of the statute is an extreme concern with a very, very limited exception in Section 2. And the other example I would give is we've had a number of situations where we had practitioners who participated with the drug companies in billing free samples to the Oregon Medicaid program. I gave the example of Abbott Labs. The TAP pharmaceutical case was another situation, and we actually did pursue a civil case. We did it under federal law as opposed to state law against a physician who participated. His office submitted bills to the Medicare and Medicaid program for the free samples that he actually received. The option in doing a case like that is either you do a civil case or a criminal case. If we proceed the case criminally, the person could be convicted, stripped of his medical license, and prohibited from acting in any capacity as a Medicaid or Medicare-funded provider. When you're dealing with a rural practitioner who may be, for example, the only cardiac surgeon in a 500-mile radius, our preference for, again, public protection is to pursue a civil action so that we're not criminally pursuing a physician in those circumstances. But if this is on the books, that's going to limit our ability to look at civil cases.
Follow, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Pellegrini, how many cases of this kind does the state of Oregon go after on an annual basis? In other words, how many lawsuits are filed against pharmaceutical companies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I would say, at least three or four a year for the past 3 years. But even prior to that, the Mylan case was... 5 years ago?
Mylan case was 5 years ago, Mr. Chair, representative members of the committee. If you combine our two units, I would say it's probably closer to seven or eight with a bullet. I looked at my docket this morning. A number of my cases are under seal, but I have in excess of a dozen currently under investigation.
And we have four pending in my office right now, which are in the investigatory stage. So I would say over the past 5 years, the Attorney General's offices nationwide and in Oregon have had increasing concern as expressed by the focus of our investigations in this area, specifically around deceptive marketing practices that have had the effect of preventing the public from either having accurate information, and by the public I mean prescribing physicians as well as consumers, either accurate information with which to choose which drug they should prescribe or be taking, and also cases involving pharmaceutical companies' behavior that is specifically intended to keep less expensive drugs off the market. And we have a concern about that, both from a legal and a social perspective, because as the witness to my right has testified, the cost of prescription drugs for Oregonians has become a paramount concern to Attorney General Myers.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As kind of a follow-up on Representative Garrard's questions, it seems like Oregon's probably made a substantial amount of money on civil litigation against the pharmaceuticals, and you mentioned basically two categories of suits that you pursue, and one would essentially boil down to being a post-approval disclosure or lack thereof or deceptive practices kind of related to that, and then also related to, on the other hand, to their behavior in suppressing their competition, I guess you could say. Now, which ones are most often, do you pursue the most? Is it the post-approval disclosure problem that you see is the most prevalent, or is it the other behavior-related one you're describing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, it's both. It's both. It's not one or the other.
Equally,
it's
then.
It's equally. And I would say that our sections work in conjunction. The Medicaid Fraud Unit deals with conduct that affects, that impacts the Medicaid program and the funds that it pays or receives. And then what my section does is that we look at that body of law which protects consumers at large. But a lot of the conduct that we're talking about, I mean, affects both of these groups. And there hasn't been any trend one way or the other. What we've seen is that pharmaceuticals companies have engaged in a whole array of unlawful activity designed to prop up their profit for a branded drug and increase the market share for a branded drug and to protect the market for a branded drug as against the entry into the market of less expensive generics.
I would add to that category, Representative Thatcher, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, pricing, because I think that just focusing on both the post-approval marketing really takes away the pricing, because Pricing is a form of marketing, however. It's how do I price my product to capture the greatest amount of share while not having to pay out anything in the Medicaid drug rebate program. And so, and I would say these things are cyclical. We settled a case with Bayer Pharmaceuticals over AWP pricing approximately 6 years ago, AWP pricing to the Medicaid program. As a result of that, we had a number of AWP cases. We then began pursuing best price cases, the failure to pay the Medicaid drug rebate accurately. We've had a whole host of cases along those lines, including another one with Bayer and one with GlaxoSmithKline over failure to pay adequate drug rebates. Most recently, one dealt with Claritin and Shearing Plow that I was one of the leads on out of Philadelphia. As a result of the Neurontin case, when that became public, now off-label marketing and post-approval probably is sharing with best price underpayment for my unit as competing for which is the most frequently pursued types of cases. And I have a 12-person unit. I could easily take everybody off everything else we do and do nothing but drug pricing cases, although I don't think we'd be fulfilling our responsibility to Oregonians by that.
Okay, further questions from the committee? Okay, seeing none, then I'll excuse this panel, and this exhausts my witnesses.
Thank you very much.
On House Bill 2743, anyone else wishing to testify that has not testified on this bill? Seeing none, then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2743. We'll proceed into the public hearing on 2749, which I opened earlier. And I'll call Kimberly, it looks like Kimberly Allen. Is it Carla Phillips? I'm having a hard time with that handwriting. May come forward. Michelle Townsend and Bruce Bishop have four up here, and these are the four that I have signed up for this bill. I know that Ms. Allen has indicated that she's in favor of the bill. The others didn't give a preference, but I'd like to have the proponents, the people in favor of the bill, go first. And I don't know who you are, with the exception of Ms. Allen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Kimberly Elaine. I am in favor of this bill. I am from St. Vincent de Paul Society. And I guess I'll just go ahead.
Yes, yeah, that's fine. Go ahead.
What I'd like to share about the benefits of this bill is that our organization, we have district councils throughout the state of Oregon. And what we do is we're locally based. We have people of faith and people of goodwill throughout the state of Oregon that act out of that faith-based mandate to care for their neighbors. And what we do a variety of things. No act of charity or justice is outside of that realm of activity. As an example of that, we do, our conference members throughout the state of Oregon do what we call home visits. And that is that government agencies, other nonprofits, churches, other organizations call the conference and say, we have an individual or a family that is in crisis. Would you be willing to go visit them and see what the situation is and how can you help? And they automatically respond. They do this. These are volunteers. These are not paid staff members. They do this because they care about their community. They do it because it's the right thing to do. Another activity that we do is we operate food banks throughout the state of Oregon. And we feed the hungry because we believe that nobody should be hungry in Oregon. And we operate out of a donation base as well as Second Harvest Oregon Food Bank operation, which has a large, generally is largely donated goods. The other things that we do is we just, whatever a community needs, we do. We provide affordable housing. We provide financial assistance. We provide, when we can, transportation. We try to fill in the gaps to help people move from the crisis they're in to out of crisis. We provide job training, education opportunities throughout the state. The challenge that we run into as a nonprofit is that the market availability for liability insurance is very limited for nonprofits. And the two risk factors that we face that makes that excessive is, one, the volunteer component of the organizations. Insurance companies find volunteers a very difficult risk factor from their practice. The other thing is that the populations that we're dealing with are deemed a high-risk population, a vulnerable population. Well, that's why we're there, is because they're vulnerable. The liability associated with that is perceived to be grave. And so that's why I'm in favor of this, is to limit that liability. We have private insurance, but again, that market is limited, and we're just looking for limiting that exposure so that we can just do the things we want to do. An example of one thing that we can no longer do because the liability is too great, and we as an organization have, unfortunately, felt forced out of this, and that is we rely primarily on donated goods. We no longer can accept baby furniture such as cribs, playpens, car seats to give to families that are in need because the liability associated with those items are so great. Passing this legislation would limit that liability risk. We take risks all the time to meet the needs of the vulnerable in our community. We're just concurring with this bill that limiting that just helps us because we're a nonprofit. We're not making lots of money here. And so I would just like to thank you for considering this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll take it from the whole panel, and so just stay here, and then maybe we may be able to ask you some questions. Whomever wishes to go next, state your name for the record, please.
Hi, my name is Michelle Townsend. Can you hear me okay? I'm from Hermiston, Oregon, and I am a widow and the mother of two children, a 9-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl. My husband was Joe Townsend. He died because the doctors and nurses at Good Shepherd Medical Center in Hermiston failed to do their job. Joe went in for an emergency appendectomy on June 10, 2003, and he died 9 days later of a massive brain hemorrhage. It is extremely rare that anyone would die from an uncomplicated appendectomy. Less than 1% of the population, especially a young, healthy male, which my husband was. Joe was only 42 years old when he died. It is completely unheard of that anyone would suffer a brain hemorrhage following an appendectomy. My husband weighed 190 pounds when he entered the hospital. Over the next 4 days, he gained 20 pounds from an imbalance between fluids given to him intravenously by the hospital, and he decreased urinary output. In addition, his blood pressure and heart rate fell to dangerously low levels. There simply was not sufficient medical response to the situation. The doctors and nurses continued to intravenously feed my husband fluids. On the third day after Joe's surgery, Joe's doctor left for a vacation and merely left a note at the nursing station that a backup doctor should take over his care. When the nurses attempted to reach the backup doctor, they had to call him twice. It took 3 hours for the doctor to respond. When he did, the hospital chart shows that he merely phoned in an order that a nasogastric tube be inserted to relieve nausea. When that did not work, the nurse made 2 more phone calls to the doctor, who again took hours to respond. By the time the doctor arrived after 10 o'clock on the third day, emergency measures were started. Efforts were made to urgently increase the urinary output and to raise his blood pressure and heart rate. Unfortunately, they overshot their target and the blood pressure and heart rate skyrocketed. Joe went into a coma and had to be life-flighted to Emmanuel Legacy in Portland. The damage was irreversible and Joe never woke up from his coma. I urge you to oppose this bill for the simple reason that hospitals and other institutions should not escape accountability when they harm their patients. What happened to Joe and my family was horrible and wrong. It should not happen to other Oregon families, but it does. Oregon's own Patient Safety Commission has estimated that in the year 2000, between 700 and 1,800 Oregonians died in hospitals and medical settings because of medical mistakes. That's too large of a number. Too many families have gone through unnecessary grief. Oregon should work to improve patient safety, not limit Oregonians' access to justice, or to let hospitals and other nonprofits off the hook when they do wrong. Moreover, this bill doesn't just apply to nonprofit hospitals, but broadly to nonprofits in general. In one stroke, you would limit the accountability and responsibility of a whole class of institutions. That's wrong and dangerous. This bill is even more sweeping than the two ballot measures Oregonians already rejected. Oregonians repeatedly have said no to limiting their rights and our access to justice. Please listen to Oregon voters and reject this bill. We all are accountable for our actions. We all are supposed to have access to justice and to hold people and institutions accountable when they harm others. Don't take away our basic rights. Work instead to improve patient safety so what happened to Joe doesn't happen to any other Oregonians. Thank you.
Please proceed. Give us your name for the record first, and then you may start.
Okay. My name is Carla Phillips, and I'm from Albany, Oregon. I would just like to tell you what happened to me. First of all, I went into the hospital for open heart surgery. And when I went in there, the doctor said, "Don't worry about this. I've done it every day. This is a piece of cake. Well, when I went, then I think the surgery went fine. But when I was in the recovery room, my chest cavity started filling up with blood. And they called the doctor. And he said to, they gave me more blood. And it wasn't going out like it should. It was pooling up in my chest. And they called the doctor, I think, every hour for 12 hours before he came in. And by then, prior to that, they knew that I should go back into surgery. And so by the time he got there, my heart stopped. And and because my cavity was filled up with water, blood, I mean. And anyway, I was without oxygen for about, I'm thinking maybe 5 minutes, and it caused me to have a stroke, which is why I have difficulty speaking, and also it caused me to lose my vision. So I, of course, don't have notes here to help me out. I really think that you should not take away the right of us to hold the people that make mistakes accountable the same way as anyone else is held accountable for their actions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, all of you. Questions from the committee? You've done well. No questions. So you're excused for a few minutes. And I'm going to call Bruce Bishop and call again Mr. Mannix to the table.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I am not representing any individual member of the Hospital Association. The Hospital Association supports House Bill 2749. Increasingly, nonprofit organizations are carrying out governmental responsibilities to protect the public's health, safety, and welfare. We think that House Bill 2749 would balance the liability exposure that nonprofit organizations, including hospitals, are entitled to. I would like to express some concern with the previous testimony that the subcommittee heard, both from Mr. Mannix and from Mr. Lane. with regard to Mr. Mannix's amendments, I believe that a monetary threshold on what constitutes charity care is not warranted, and instead this subcommittee should consider a functional analysis and not an arbitrary dollar limit on executive compensation or any other measure of an organization's charitable activities. If it's his belief that an organization does not qualify for nonprofit charitable status, I think there are remedies for that. But I don't believe that drawing a line in statute about what constitutes charity is the way to approach that issue. Second, with regard to Mr. Lane's testimony, I would only point out that his disparaging hospitals as not really being nonprofit organizations is neither helpful nor accurate, and we would object to that characterization. Representative McPherson asked specifically whether there had been examples of nonprofit organizations having tort claims limits. I would draw the committee's attention to the bill and to ORS 30.260, which is proposed to be amended. Subsection D of subsection B, which subsection 4D defines public body as including any nonprofit corporation organized under the Oregon nonprofit law that has as its members political subdivisions or municipal, quasi-municipal, or public corporations in the state. That is one example of tort claims extensions to nonprofit organizations. In addition, subsection F, which starts on line 23 of the bill, extends tort claim protections to private child caring agencies that meet certain criteria, including 50% of their funding comes from the state, and they provide care for children who are in the care and custody of the state. In both of those instances, I think there are examples of nonprofit organizations performing governmental functions where the legislature has extended tort claims limits to those entities, and we believe that House Bill 2749 accomplishes the same purpose for other nonprofit organizations. We would urge the committee's approval of House Bill 2749 and would be glad to work with you if you have any further questions on it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll take questions in a moment and hear again from Mr. Mannix.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate Mr. Bischoff's remarks here, but the original bill was a very broad bill, and you could make arguments about it one way or another, but we quite deliberately chose to ask for narrowing amendments to stay away from health care in this legislation, because health care has got its own package of issues and concerns that should be addressed in more specialized legislation. Sometimes health care can be addressed in some general tort reform legislation, but it became apparent as we worked on this legislation that we needed to stick to what I call community services, services that are designed to specifically provide and affect social services and support services for the poor and the dispossessed. And so we shifted the target here. And I would agree with Mr. Bischoff that if this bill were to be simply covering nonprofits and that included hospitals, then this cap on employee pay should be taken out, because there could be cases made for extraordinary compensation for hospital administrators and the like. They run gigantic corporations with tremendous responsibilities, and I respect that. The package of amendments moves this bill completely away from health care and says address health care separately, but let's talk about social services for the poor and the dispossessed and for organizations that in effect specialize in providing those services. So we've narrowed the range of the bill, and in so doing, and talking to folks about those organizations, I having had a chance to read the amendment since my earlier testimony, we do have a cap here saying no employee of such a nonprofit should receive more than $200,000 per fiscal year in wages and benefits. That may be a figure that you may want to take it out, you may want to modify it, but we were trying to come in with a focus on what community service organizations such as St. Vincent de Paul, which you heard from today, which largely rely on volunteers with a few key staff who are paid, who are trying very hard to provide services to a high-risk population and with services that themselves are high-risk. So with due respect, the original bill may have been a great idea. The testimony of the two ladies who are unfortunate victims of health care crises would apply to the original bill, but their testimony would not apply to the Dash 1 amended bill.
Thank you for your testimony, and let's just hold it and see if we have any questions for a moment, for a minute. Questions? Representative Garrard?
I was just curious. Bruce, how many hospitals are there in Oregon?
Approximately 60.
And follow?
Yes.
Of those 60, how many are nonprofit?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, there are about half of them are governmental. All of the rest are nonprofit except for three hospitals in the state. We have three for-profit hospitals in the state. So there are three types of hospitals, basically governmental, nonprofit, and for-profit. But we have three for-profit hospitals.
Thank you. Thank you for your questions and answers. Further questions? I just have a brief one to probably to both of you on page 1, line 23 that Mr. Bishop related to as an example of a nonprofit organization having some form of sovereign immunity. The real test there, though, is that the state must pay 50% of funding, and that's really the true one of the tests for an instrumentality of an agency in performing state functions. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a reasonable test, and it's certainly within the purview of the Assembly to set those sorts of thresholds. Depending on where you set those thresholds, many hospitals would qualify as instrumentalities if Medicaid and Medicare payments that those hospitals receive are included within that scope. So there is a definitional line there, but clearly, to the extent that hospitals are providing governmental services, we think that they should be entitled to similar protection.
And the second question to both of you. In the amendment, the test is that the corporation, nonprofit, spend at least 40% on food banks, soup kitchens, etc. That's just 40% of their revenues. It doesn't have the instrumentality test. Is there any reason for that, or... is that instrumentality test that I referenced necessary to provide immunity to nonprofit organizations?
Mr. Chairman, in response to that, the 40% is an initial bargaining chip. My view is if you have an organization that's spending at least 40%, and has been doing that for at least 3 years, that is providing community services, it may be preferable to change that figure to raise the bar, if you will. I certainly prefer to come in at 40% than at 50 or 60%. But certainly the idea is to make sure it's an organization that is truly serving the poor and the dispossessed with its expenditures and not serving other causes.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond to those amendments as well. And obviously we had not seen those before this morning's hearing. While Mr. Mannix suggests that they're limited and do not include health care services, I don't read them so narrowly. And I believe under the amendments as drafted, hospitals would qualify as providers of special community services. So if they provided at least 40% of their services to those listed but not necessarily exclusive services, they too would be entitled to the protection of the Tort Claims Act.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Seeing none.
Mr. Bishop, would any of the hospitals, assuming that they satisfied the community service requirement, would any of them qualify under the prohibition on having an employee who earns more than $200,000 in wages and benefits, given that many hospitals will have staff physicians who in certain special areas of practice would have incomes that would be above that level?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I believe that there are hospitals who would have employees, including physicians, who might be disqualified under that provision.
Thank you. May I respond?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I think he's right. The intention of this amendment was to exclude hospitals and to exclude health care providers, and if we need to make that precise in those amendments, we should say so, because I do not want to get into the health care debate in this bill, in this revised form. The intention is to talk about social services to the poor and dispossessed.
Fine, thank you. Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Worth.
Can I just ask a quick thing, Mr. Chair? I'm just trying to envision this language for the amendments that Dash runs and how it would qualify under them. Can you give me an example of what would qualify as a nonprofit with doing rent and utility assistance and transportation assistance?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth. There are a number of organizations that will help the poor with their rent. They will provide either a direct subsidy or they will provide affordable housing. There are nonprofit corporations that receive some government assistance as well as private grants to establish affordable housing that is less costly housing for those persons who are low-income levels. The transportation programs include providing, for instance, a ride service for people who need to go to a clinic or need to go in for appointments. And there are social service organizations that actually do provide transportation in that way. There are also organizations that will help you come up with the funds to get your deposit together for a used car, those kinds of organizations. It's all in the context of helping the poor.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
I think maybe I didn't ask this quickly. I realize that, but just can you give me a couple of examples of the corporations out there that exist doing this?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, if you go down to Eugene Springfield and visit with the St. Vincent de Paul operations down there, they have several for-profit operations and a host of non-profit operations, including affordable housing, including transportation programs. They provide, in effect, a network of what we would have called in the old days welfare programs in the Springfield-Eugene communities. You heard testimony in regard to St. Vincent de Paul. It has these local councils throughout the state. They're looking to Eugene Springfield as a model for what they can do, and they largely rely on volunteers in providing these kinds of services. But I did a tour about a month ago down in Eugene Springfield, and I actually could not get around to all of the service providers that they had just from that one organization, all for people who are at some federal poverty level standard, people who are, and again, I call them the poor and the dispossessed or low-income people.
My familiarity with St. Vincent de Paul, weren't they the primary contractors that did the work when we had Jobs Plus going full speed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you.
I can tell you that other kinds of organizations that are intended to be covered here are groups such as the Boys and Girls Clubs, YMCA programs for families and kids, what you would traditionally think of community service programs that might qualify for United Way assistance.
Thank you.
Okay, further questions?
Yes.
Hearing none. You're excused. Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else willing to testify on House Bill 2749? Hearing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2749. And with that, we'll move to our second block of cases this morning, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2745 and 2747. Ask Mr. Mannix and Representative of the Oregon Trial Lawyers to come forward and give us their summary. And while you are assembling, I'll have counsel explain the bills.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2745 imposes pleading requirements for professional liability claims. It requires that a claim must be accompanied by a certification by the claimant's attorney that states that the attorney has consulted with the person who holds the same license, registration, or certificate as the defendant, and who is qualified, available, and willing to testify to admissible facts and opinions sufficient to create a question of fact as to professional liability. There are currently specific bills similar to this for specific professions, such as architects. And earlier this session, we heard Hospital 2634, which established comparable requirements for real estate licensees. Hospital 2747 requires that a court award a reasonable attorney fees to the prevailing party if the court finds that a frivolous claim, defense, or ground for appeal or review was asserted against that party. that provides that a claim, defense, or ground for appeal or review is frivolous if it is either not supported by substantial evidence or if it is asserted without a reasonable prospect of prevailing. There's currently a similar statute, a statute that awards attorney's fees, and the standard for that is that there's no objectively reasonable basis for asserting the claim. That standard was changed in 1995 from what was a subjective standard to that objective standard. This bill changes it to the standards that I previously mentioned.
I guess, counsel, you can make your opening statements.
Thank you, Mr. Mannix. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix, a Salem attorney, here appearing here as project manager for the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project. In regard to House Bill 2745, this is an expansion of a concept that has been recognized by the legislature. As mentioned by counsel, in the 2003 session, ORS 31.300 was adopted, which included certain pleading requirements for actions against construction design professionals, more commonly known as architects. And in the 2005 session, this committee has passed out House Bill 2634 with amendments, which provides for pleading requirements for actions against real estate licensees. What this bill does is take that concept a step further and say, if you are an Oregon licensed professional, why not have, for all Oregon licensed professionals, a standard of care, if you will, in regard to a lawsuit to be brought against that licensed professional that includes certain preliminary requirements which need to be met. So it takes a good idea and expands it to cover all Oregon licensed professionals. And in terms of the definition of a licensed professional in 2745, we are talking about professional liability claims, and the standards that we're talking about in the bill talks about a licensed professional, a person who's consulted, who holds the same license, registration, or certificate as the defendant, and who is qualified, available, and willing to testify. We think it's a good idea to apply it across the board, so anytime you're going to hold a licensed professional subject to litigation, then you've got somebody else who is willing to go forward and say they did something wrong and that somebody else is a qualified person. That's the essence of that bill. Do you want me to speak to the other bill?
Yes, let's do it that way.
As to House Bill 2747, this is an attempt to take us a step further with a two-edged sword as to frivolous claims or defenses. I emphasize the defense side, too, because I recognize that either side of the bar can come forward with frivolous issues in litigation. And it's not just the plaintiff's side, but the defendant's side, which needs to be careful about making use of court resources, bringing expense to the other side, bringing expense to society with litigation which may not have any reasonable prospect for success. The 1995 language, that there was no objectively reasonable basis for asserting the party's claim or defense or ground for appeal, was an advancement, was an improvement. But as applied by the courts, it has not really, in our opinion, in my opinion, demonstrated great substance. There are standards available which are presented in this bill which we believe are more easily ascertainable and more easily applied. And here is a determination that the claim, defense, or ground for appeal, A, was not supported by substantial evidence. Now, that's a term of art that is well established in administrative law. It's not a preponderance of the evidence, but it's a substantial evidence standard. And in administrative law, over decades now, courts have given deference to decisions of agencies based on substantial evidence. What is substantial evidence? They turn to the agency, they give the agency discretion, and they say there just has to be enough, and this is my layman's parlance here, has to be enough evidence that a reasonable person could have relied on that evidence in making a decision. The second part has to do that no reasonable prospect of prevailing on the claim, defense, or ground for appeal. The essence there is looking at the prospect for prevailing rather than the logic that might be used. If you take a look at this, is there a reasonable basis to believe that you can prevail? It's one thing to say, I can make a shot at it, I've got an objectively reasonable basis for asserting it, hey, I get to make the argument, as opposed to saying the argument has any traction whatsoever. And this is an attempt to shift the legislative standard that's presented to the courts to say, you have to show that your argument has traction, not that you can just make a good argument. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lane?
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Richard Lane. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and in opposition to both 2745 and 2747. Starting with 2745, the scope of this bill would apply to any profession regulated, certified by Oregon State. That's a long list that you're talking about, from electricians, pilots, barbers, fishermen, teachers, veterinarians, just a few that you're expanding the scope out. Now, Mr. Mannix has referenced the bill from the last session that applies to architects and engineers. And that bill became law in what is now ORS 31.300, a pleading requirement for actions against construction design professionals. And I would commend to the committee and its members Section 5, which specifically excludes the requirement for a certificate against innocent bystanders or people that don't have access to the information that a licensed professional architect or engineer does. The committee staff summary measures in this committee and also the Senate notes that certain individuals, such as bystanders and laborers, do not typically have access to the blueprints and or witnesses necessary to provide a consulting expert to obtain an opinion that the claim in question has merit. The Senate goes on and, by amendment, narrows the application of the measure to cover only those types of persons or entities who typically have access to blueprints and or witnesses necessary to provide a consulting expert to obtain an opinion that the claim in question has merit. So the first thing is, it doesn't apply already in Oregon to an injured victim. What it does apply to in construction, engineering, and architecture situations is we have competing interests, and everybody's got the blueprints, and there's a dispute over whether this was supposed to be done or this was supposed to be done or who's supposed to pay for this, that we carved out a limited exception based upon the testimony of that industry, and it only applies to a licensed professional suing the other licensed professional. It does not apply to bystanders or innocent parties like 2745 would. 2747, the one thing that's omitted in any of the discussions here is what's called ORCP 17, which is a certification now when any attorney signs a complaint, an answer, or makes a third-party claim. They're certifying the soundness, the good faith, the lack of frivolousness associated with that claim, defense, or third-party claim. And there's Oregon law clearly providing guidelines to all practitioners about what is and what is not frivolous litigation. 2747 overrules all of that case law, and it also overrules what is known as FRCP 11, which the Oregon courts have routinely looked to, which also examines when an attorney can be found to have brought a frivolous piece of litigation either by complaint, defense, or third-party claim. And the court notes in a case called Matiza versus Foster, 311 Oregon 1, that Oregon has struck a balance between making sure that we don't impose a chilling effect on pursuing litigation. 2747 actually will do that. It will chill litigation because the only time it's not going to be frivolous is if you could prevail. That's the only time you would have a success prevailing. The Matiza case notes that a lot of litigation involves a reviewing court taking a look at something under the present standard where there is not a lack of objective, reasonable belief in the ability to prevail. So I would encourage you to stick with what we have now between ORCP 17, the existing 20.105, and the 2747 is unnecessary for Oregon.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Girard.
Mr. Lane, in regard to the prevailing attitude, and I'm not an attorney, so you have to educate me here. Why would you take a case you knew you were going to lose?
Representative Girard, members of the committee, you would not. There is no sense in pursuing a case that you are going to lose. But I will say that some
litigation has led to advancements in protections for consumers, for business entities, and sometimes a case is actually lost to the trial court level and then turned out to prevail at the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court level because one or the other of the courts thought that there was a need for a change in the law.
Okay, thank you.
May I respond to that also?
You may.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, the reason you take a case that you might lose is not because you intend to go to trial and lose, but you intend to negotiate for a settlement before you go to trial. And there are all the defense costs that the defense have to consider. And they're considerable in many a case. And I will tell you, you know, after 31 years of practice, I don't know how many times I've practically spoken to a client saying, look, we will win this case at trial or at hearing, but it's going to cost us X dollars to do that. And so let's talk about a settlement for below that amount, cost-benefit analysis, cost of doing business, and sometimes, most times, the client will buy into that and will negotiate a settlement. Now, I'm not saying the attorney brought the case with that intention in mind, but the reality of the game is, the litigation game is, that if you've just got a shadow of a case, one that you wouldn't dare take in front of a jury or a judge or a hearings officer, you may still proceed with that at the beginning in the hopes that the side on the other side will ante up some money. Now, I'll throw it on the defense side. There are times when defense lawyers may well say, well, we're in real trouble. We won't want to go to trial on this, but let's throw up all these defenses, create enough smoke, put up enough mirrors up that we can delay this and whittle them down and wear them out. It cuts both ways, and in both cases, I think this kind of legislation would reduce the tendency to engage in that kind of conduct.
Okay, further questions? Representative Worth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, would most lawyers or most people all agree on the same definition of what is reasonable prospect of prevailing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, that's a good question. The definition of a reasonable prospect of prevailing may require some amendment in this bill so that we can get better agreement on it. The difference is right now we have no objectively reasonable basis for asserting. Is there any basis for you to make the argument that the earth is flat? Well, I could probably come up with one, and you might say it's not objectively reasonable. Someone else might say it is. As opposed to reasonable, the language here is no reasonable prospect of prevailing. Perhaps that should be changed to no objectively reasonable prospect of prevailing. But on the prevailing side, you get to take a look at the world around you and make a determination pretty quickly from a common sense perspective. Can you really get anywhere with that? And I think you could very easily tell me that there is no objectively reasonable prospect for me to prevail on the assertion that the earth is flat.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
This is a question for Mr. Mannix. When we passed the statute last session affecting certain design professionals, it was a response to information we had that there were it was a complex setting in which to be litigating. There were a lot of multiple parties and that design professionals were likely to be included in the net of co-defendants and that in order to encourage plaintiff's counsel to be discriminating about who they included in that net and who they didn't, we passed that statute. Extending it to all licensed professionals, and by my reading, it's not really just professionals, it's anybody who holds an occupational trade license in Oregon. I guess I'm wondering who's left. I mean, isn't the exception starting to overwhelm the rule if we were to enact this, and we should say that every tort case ought to have certain pleading requirements that would precede the action?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, good question, fair question. The gentle general response I'll give you is you always shoot for the moon when you begin the discussion, and then you can work your way back. And in this case, we're shooting for the moon. And if the committee finds that the concept of expanding the design professional concept a bit is practical, we can come up with definitions that are limiting in this legislation. I would say that the essential idea is a good one. Anytime you're going to drag somebody into litigation, and they're a licensed professional, however we want to define it, you ought to be able to say in Oregon, and this is the standard we want, I've talked to another person who's got a license in that profession who's prepared to say he done wrong. And that is a common sense standard that ought to be applied in some fashion to a broader range of cases.
Okay. Sounds like settlement negotiations have opened up, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Further questions, Representative Worth.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just one final question. Can you give me an example of, are there any other limits similar to this put on a person's right to appeal in the law?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, the actual legislation in place right now applies, the current standards apply to appeals as well as to trials, and this bill would do the same thing. So in that sense, we are taking what currently applies to appeals and trials and expanding the concept as to appeals and trials.
Thank you.
Further questions? I have one of both of you. Just a hypothetical in which I have a case, existing law is against me. I'm arguing for a reasonable extension of existing law. I lose. Is my case frivolous and I get assessed attorney's fees?
Mr. Chairman, are you asking me to respond to that?
Both of you.
All right. Mr. Chairman, the reasonable prospect of prevailing includes, I think, a reasonable prospect of extending existing law. You could make the argument in many a case that the trend is in this direction. It doesn't say a good prospect. It doesn't say an excellent prospect. It says a reasonable prospect. And that key word allows you to point to the world around and say, this has been the direction, this has been the concept, we think we can extend it, and that would be a reasonable prospect.
Mr. Lane?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in fact, 2747 would probably subject you to attorney's fees, prevailing party costs, as the amendment is proposed. The fact that you are allowed to, under existing law, proceed with an appeal on a good faith belief in favor of extension of the law is the out that exists now. You would close that loophole under 2747, and you probably would be subject to attorney's fees and costs as prevailing party.
I see we have no agreement. Thank you. Further questions from the committee then? Okay, I'll excuse this panel, and I'm going to proceed on 2745, and I have two other witnesses, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Crew. Would you like to each come forward, please? May we get in any order you wish. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Johnston. I'm a former state representative who sat there 10 years ago and passed the bill that Representative Mannix was referring to that established the standard of no objection, objectively reasonable. First of all, I'd like to commend anyone who's interested in improving justice. I think we all have that obligation, and so I think this situation is a worthy one. For the past 21 years, I've been involved, I think, in that movement. I was one of the founding faculty members of the Center for Dispute Resolution at Willamette University College of Law that really introduced or spearheaded the efforts of bringing dispute resolution as a field of inquiry into the legal profession, and I've been active in the field since then. We had one standard that we tried to advance with each of the suggestions we made at that time. I would commend it to you, and it's the reason I'm here testifying today. And that standard was first do no harm. And I think both of the bills in question and this moment in your discussion failed that standard because they both do harm. Very briefly, 2745. Which extends to all professions the requirement that you additionally receive permission from some other professional to sue the second professional, alters, in effect, the who's the jury. You have to clear an additional hurdle before you can get into the courtroom. That's an imposition on a plaintiff or, in the case of defense, that shouldn't exist. You should not put additional obstacles in the way of having questions resolved. Second, the 2747, Representative Ackerman, you stole the direction that I wanted to proceed on that one. I think that the problem with 2747 is exactly what you outlined. 2747, in effect, stops the progress of law. Our common law system is made up of men and women who challenge the existing rule. and try and define things based upon, and I'll give you a very simple example, based upon their sense of what's appropriate. And I had a case about 15 years ago that fell under what was known then as the shopkeeper's rule. It was a simple case of something on the floor, and my client slipped and broke her leg in a shop. The shopkeeper's rule is an old rule dating from about the 1600s, and it said that the shopkeeper knew or should have known of the existence of the condition. And that rule had been changed in many of our surrounding states because of the modern way that things are merchandised. In other words, when there was a shopkeeper's rule, there was a shopkeeper who was keeping track of his store. But when you then go to large box self-service stores, you might have aisles and aisles where there is no one looking at what's going on in that aisle. And there might not be anyone down there for 15, 20, 30 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour. And so I brought our case in an effort to extend to Oregon the modern rule, which is that or reasonably should have known. And that lawsuit was unsuccessful at the trial level and unsuccessful at the Court of Appeals. And so I think I would have been sanctioned for trying to advance the law. About 3 years later, that rule was changed in Oregon because someone else did the same thing, bucked the odds and took it to the court, and realizing that they would lose the trial and would try and prevail at the Court of Appeals. That's for the past several hundred years how our law advances case by case, precedent by precedent, and 2747 would stop the march of progress.
Thank you. Mr. Crewe?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mike Crewe. I'm the attorney for the Oregon Medical Association, law firms Cooney and Crewe. The OMA supports House Bill 2745 relative to the requirement to have the certification, if you will, that the plaintiff's counsel has conferred with an expert, an expert of the same license to determine or is willing to testify that, in fact, professional error has occurred. I want to point out to the committee that it is impossible in this state, except in the very limited circumstances, to prevail on a medical malpractice claim without an expert. And I also want to point out to the committee that the vast majority, probably in excess of 80% of the medical malpractice claims asserted in this state, are either closed without payment or they lose at trial. One of the major expenses that insurance companies are faced with in this state that insure physicians is the cost of defense. And it seems that it's a simple, common sense approach to say, if you're going to sue a doctor, you've got to have someone who is qualified as an expert to get on the witness stand before you file a lawsuit and say the doctor did wrong. The notion of filing the lawsuit and then fishing around and looking for an expert and then ultimately not finding one and closing the claim just runs up the cost of defense. And again, as I said in my previous testimony, the OMA has dedicated a great deal of money, time, and expense, if you will, to try to stop frivolous litigation, and we think that House Bill 2745 is a step in the right direction.
I thank you both for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Worth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question regarding 2745. Can you tell me, wouldn't there be a situation where there might be a highly specialized, licensed medical professional? There's only a couple of them in the country, and then so we would have to get the exact same licensed professional to testify, or not to testify, but sign this claim that they've looked over the charges. So isn't there a situation where there could be again just a highly specialized license that only a few people hold in the country?
Representative Worth, Mr. Chairman, I assume that question is directed to me, and the answer is, generally speaking, if you're licensed to practice medicine in this state, you're licensed to practice medicine, period. There are recognized subspecialties, neurology, neurosurgery, whatever the case may be, and the bill doesn't parse down that far. It simply says someone who is licensed in the same profession who will testify that the standard has been breached. Now, whether or not the person who is willing to testify the standard's been breached could, in fact, qualify as an expert in that particular case if they were called the witness stand is a different issue. But I'm suggesting that you should at least have a licensed physician, whether they're licensed in this state or some other jurisdiction, if you're going to sue a doctor which says, or who says, that the defendant doctor committed malpractice.
And that simple step should, and if it's observed by the bar, cut off a great deal of litigation in this state. I sat back several years ago as chair of one of the ethics committees of the Oregon State Bar. It was a committee that investigated allegations of wrongful conduct by attorneys, and we had the pleasure of investigating an attorney who, in fact, told the court they had an expert in a medical malpractice case when they didn't. And the attorney was disciplined for it. Properly so. But the point here is that these cases are filed without the necessary predicate of expert support. And again, if you're going to sue a doctor in this state and take it to trial, you're going to have an expert to testify. What is so inherently wrong with requiring that the expert be in place before the lawsuit's filed, as opposed to incurring tremendous defense costs to defend a claim that essentially is never going to make it to court? We think 2745 solves that.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
You may.
So this would, 2745, would this preclude a midwife then testifying against or qualifying as a licensed professional regarding a claim against a doctor, OBGYN's delivery of a child?
The way I read the bill, Representative Worth, yes, it would not allow a midwife to testify against a physician.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, then I'll excuse you. I'll have Mr. Johnson just sit here for a moment because we're going to go to the next bill, and I know that your testimony lapsed over into that bill, but you may have some more. So why don't you sit where you are, and I'll proceed into House Bill 2747 and ask Mr. Fuller to come forward. I didn't know, Mr. Johns, if you had, you'd lapsed into the other bill. I didn't know if you concluded your testimony on that or not. But
I have. I've always enjoyed listening to Mr. Fulton.
Aye.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Darrell Fuller. I'm here in two capacities this morning. First, primarily, as I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Secondarily, I also wear the hat this session as being president of the Oregon Small Business Coalition, which is a coalition of businesses that primarily do retail-related businesses in the state of Oregon. And I'm here in favor of House Bill 2747. Prior to coming this morning, I put the words lawyer joke in a Yahoo search engine and came out with 1,720,000 hits on the web. There were really too many good lawyer jokes to bring them all this morning, but one really sort of caught my attention, and it was an attorney who was sitting or standing before a judge and somebody on the witness stand who was wearing overalls, and the attorney said, "Aha, so you admit it. You're the one who grew the corn that was used by the distiller to make the whiskey that was sold to the bar that was given to my client that caused him to be drunk, too drunk to know that he shouldn't be driving, and so you're responsible for the accident." And that is obviously an exaggeration of what some businesses feel like they face in the world of litigation, but it's not too far outside of what I think businesses sometimes fear. I'm not so concerned this morning about the lawsuits that do go, or the cases that actually do go to court. What I'm concerned in the legislature trying to address in one way or another is the point that Representative Girard made earlier, and that is the atmosphere that businesses live in where a suit is threatened or a case is a letter of demand of some kind is sent out, and a business is faced with spending $30,000 or $40,000 to prove their right or spending only $20,000 to settle the case, keep it from possibly getting into the newspapers and providing bad publicity. We're in a circumstance now where because there are no limitations on claims in some ways, and I'll bring it around, and I apologize for being a little bit circular, but I'll bring it around to House Bill 2747. Businesses are in a position now where rather than determining whether or not they violated the law, they have to determine what is the least cost option for them, and often that puts them in a position of paying off a plaintiff for bringing a suit that essentially would not prevail in court. I think anything that this legislature can do that would strengthen the laws regarding frivolous lawsuits would put businesses in the position of saying, okay, go ahead and sue me more often. if you really think you have a case, you're more at risk now as a plaintiff's attorney of having to pay costs and fees if the claim is actually frivolous. So I support the idea of raising that bar, if you will. And it would seem to me that, especially when you guys were discussing the cases having to do with extending the law, by not saying that there should be costs and fees if you lose those cases, what you're suggesting, it seems to me, is that the defendants are the ones who have to bear all of the costs associated with extending the law. Because if there are never costs and fees associated with losing those cases where you try to extend the law, well, there are costs and fees. You just don't have to pay them. It's the defendant that has to pay those costs because they're not getting their attorney's fees reimbursed to them in successfully prevailing in those court cases. And so with that, I'll end my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Anything you'd like to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds to me very much like a decade-long echo chamber. We've had this discussion. We had it 10 years ago, and I'm sure they may well have it 10 years hence. There is a real problem, and Mr. Fuller points out the real problem. There are real solutions. These two bills aren't either of them.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Seeing none, I'll excuse you, and I'll ask if there's any further testimony, any person willing to testify on House Bills 2745 or 2747. Seeing none, then I'll close the public hearing on each of those bills. I thank you for keeping us on time. We really appreciate that, and we will reconvene at 3 o'clock this afternoon.
It's just the new standard, so... I mean, it takes quite a few years to work out for that. Mm-hmm. So, it doesn't really work.
Afternoon session of the House Judiciary Civil Subcommittee is in session. I apologize for the delay, but we were only attracting lawyers to the table before Representative Worth came in, and now we're ready to go. Okay. I'm going to call a public hearing on open a public hearing on House Bills 2746 and House Bill 3211. Counsel, will you explain the bills, please?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2746 and House Bill 3211 both limit contingent fees that are permitted in negligence claims. They are reach the same purpose but reach them in a different way. House Bill 2746 limits the percent that an attorney can recover in an contingent fee agreement, and House Bill 3211 limits the amount as calculated based on an hourly rate on a contingent fee agreement.
Okay, consistent with our morning practice, I'll have Mr. Mannix come forward and a representative of Outlook come forward, each given 5 minutes to give us an overview of these two bills.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm a Salem attorney. I'm here today as the project manager for the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project. In regard to the two bills which you have in front of you this afternoon for this session, 2746 and 3211, we are essentially talking about consumer protection measures. And one can engage in debate about how much consumer protection there ought to be, but this morning when I heard the Department of Justice talking about consumer protection when it comes to delivery of pharmaceuticals and medical services, I thought, well, what about consumer protection when it comes to delivery of legal services? This state does not have a strong standard in place to protect consumers against what might be considered contracts of adhesion in the delivery of legal services under a contingent fee agreement. Now, I say might be considered because there are some general standards in the law and in the standards that guide attorneys that talk about reasonableness, but there are no specific standards in terms of either the percentage of the recovery that ought to be allowed as a contingent fee or the dollars per hour that an attorney can earn as a contingent fee.
I'll be the first to grant you that we could have an interesting debate about, well, how do you calculate the dollars per hour, which comes up in House Bill 3211, and set a maximum, when you have to also consider the fact that in a contingent fee situation, lawyers lose cases, too, and then they don't recover anything at all. And so part of the equation has to be a consideration of that. You have one case where you may recover a substantial sum, and another case where you worked just as hard, but there was no recovery. Those are the kinds of things that policymakers need to take into consideration. We do have a statutory scheme in place controlling contingent fees in the workers' compensation system, and it has worked very well. It's always been the subject of statute and the subject of regulation. And the maximum fee, essentially, which you can earn under workers' compensation is 25%. The fee actually goes down as the award goes up. We consider that not as a specific guide, but as a general guide and taking a look at percentage contingent fees in House Bill 2746. I would be the first to say to you quite plainly that the dollar levels that you might want to apply may vary widely from what are suggested in this bill. This bill is a starting point for discussion. But I would say to you, at some point, when you consider the person who goes to an attorney who cannot afford to hire that attorney without agreeing to a contingent fee agreement because the person doesn't have the dollars to hire someone on a flat fee or an hourly fee basis, and that person believes that he or she has got an extraordinary legal claim to pursue, needs a lawyer to do it because, frankly, they could never succeed without one under the current litigation system, and then is facing the prospect of being told, this is our fee schedule, take it or leave it. Now, if we were talking about just about any other professional service in the state where there's no intervening factor at all to provide control, I think we'd be hearing arguments in this building about how astounded people are that there are no controlling factors, at least in terms of specifics. Now, you might take a step back and say, well, medical providers can set their fees. No, they can't. They have to negotiate with the insurance companies. They have to negotiate with the federal government. They have to negotiate with the state government. Attorneys essentially do not have to negotiate with anybody right now when someone walks through the door. Now, the other response that I generally hear is, well, the market will take care of it. Competition will take care of it. It hasn't. The fact of the matter is that the percentages that are discussed in the staff report are pretty extraordinary from my perspective in terms of potential recovery. Now, we may well hear from others who can make the case that they are not. And that is what this bill is, the first bill and the second bill are all about, is opening the discussion as to whether or not the state of Oregon should have a regulatory scheme in place which is precise about protecting consumers against what may be extraordinary awards of attorney fees, which, after all, under a contingent fee agreement, are dollars that do not go into the consumer's pocket, but instead go into the attorney's pocket. Now, I'll take one other step back in my last 30 seconds or so and say, I respect our litigation system. Goodness knows I've participated in it for 31 years. We need to be very careful about any of this legislation and not going overboard and squelching the capability of attorneys to represent their clients and to represent them and make a good living at it. But at some point, one would think that the legislature would be able to establish some clear standard as to when you've gone too far in terms of a recovery where the contingent fee is extraordinary. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lane?
Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Lane. I am here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm here to briefly comment on 2746 and 3211 and express an opposition to both bills. I'm not going to take my full 5 minutes because Linda McCatherine, sitting behind me, is going to address some of the particulars or some of the problems that are presented in 2746 and 3211. Let me just say this. For the record, the attorneys on the committee are well aware of the Oregon State Bar stance on excessive fees. The Oregon case law is clear on the sanctions and prohibitions that have been imposed, including outright disbarment for anybody who takes an excessive fee. And there's actually a long list of things to consider about whether a fee is or is not an excessive fee. But more importantly, where is the consumer outrage that the proponents apparently are claiming 2746 and 3211 are designed to remedy?
I think both bills are bills in search of a problem. Consumers are generally pleased with the ability to get access to the court. The contingency fee arrangement is the keys to the courthouse, and there does not seem to be any need for any legislative body to start examining when or whether a particular fee as such is a reasonable fee given the work that's actually done. And those are the comments I would make and answer any questions the committee may have.
All right. Questions for the committee? Representative McPherson.
Question to Mr. Maddox, just taking off on Mr. Lane's last point. You described this as a consumer protection. Will you be bringing forward any testimony from plaintiffs, either successful or not successful, complaining that they think the fees are too high?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, no. And I think the biggest problem here is that my brethren at the bar are very good at winning over their clients and convincing their clients and doing a good job for them. And people, after the fact, will be grateful for the fact that they may have gotten 46% ultimate recovery after costs and other expenses and attorney fees. They may be happy when they get 55% because they figure they're getting something, whereas they may not have gotten anything at all. That is why I would contend that sometimes you need to have an objective outside party looking at the situation and setting some sort of controls. There's a reason, I think, why the controls were set in the context of workers' compensation. It's because advocates for injured workers, not the injured workers themselves, but their advocates, and I'll say this, the unions, said we need some sort of control mechanism to make sure injured workers do get their fair share of the recovery while allowing the attorneys a reasonable recovery. We do not have any advocacy network in regard to other cases that I'm aware of.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got two questions. One is, can you tell me who's currently being harmed by the way the law is now? Is there, and kind of following up on Representative McPherson's question, who stands to harm the way it is now, leaving it the way it is now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, I'd respectfully suggest that the harm is relative, and it has to do with the consumer who has the legitimate case, who goes forward and succeeds, and ends up paying a disproportionate share of the recovery to the attorney, especially in the context of the services rendered. And I would respectfully suggest that attorneys are not necessarily the best ones to make a judgment about what is a disproportionate share, that it ought to be the representatives of the people who are in this body and in the Senate who can make some decision dispassionately about at what point have you gone too far in terms of recovery, whether it's a dollar cap, whether it's a percentage cap. And these bills open the debate on that subject. Leave it at that.
Yes, you want to follow up?
Similar follow up. And can you tell me, do you have an estimate of how many cases per year would be considered unreasonable under this bill that are occurring now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, no, I don't. And in fact, this legislation, and we're more involved in 2746, which is the percentage limitation, but also conceptually support 3211, which says there should be some dollar cap per hour. This all has to do with the conceptual value of some legislative limitation. And there ought to be plenty of room to maneuver and plenty of room to allow a good recovery for attorneys for their professional services. But at some point, there ought to be some statutory cap.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? I would maybe one or two of Mr. Mannix. These two bills seem targeted at personal injury lawyers, yet there's a wide range of cases out there that are also conducive to the contingency fee arrangement, securities violations, unlawful trade practices, employment claims, wage claims, on and on and on. Why are these bills so focused on personal injury lawyers?
Mr. Chairman, in response to that question, I think it's because we are dealing with the deepest tragedy that confronts an individual, the death of a family member, personal injury, emotional injury, and those are the areas where a person is least capable, I would assert, of making a dispassionate judgment as to what is a reasonable fee that the attorney may charge that person in those very severe circumstances. That's why it was chosen as a category.
Fine, thank you. Further questions from the committee? If not, conclude your testimony and call up our next witnesses.
Thank you.
I'm going to exhaust the witness list on House Bill 2746 first, and in that regard, I will call Scott Gallant. As a proponent, and the others on the list are opponents. I'll keep them together. Mr. Gallant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. We are in favor of having a statutory scheme to limit contingency fees. We proposed legislation in the mid-'80s. Have polled in Oregon as recently as last year regarding this issue among the public. Contingency fee limits, at least among the public, has broad support both in this state and nationally. The real issue is to what degree does an injured party actually receive a proportion of an award in this sort of case. Most studies have indicated that the injured party receives 50% or less of a judgment in these sorts of cases. I think the proponent earlier is correct in saying there are protections in 2746 to assure the ability of plaintiffs to recover their actual costs and expenses in taking these cases, as you will notice in lines 17 and 18. And similar sorts of provisions have been included in legislation or other initiatives that we have proposed in the past. I think it's interesting that one of the least understood pieces of this process is that the state has rarely, if ever, in my knowledge, introduced legislation or passed legislation that would enable the legislature to actually know with any certainty the amount of resources that actually plaintiff attorneys do receive in personal injury cases. It's not tracked and never has been to my knowledge. So just as an aside, I think it would be at least incumbent upon you as policymakers to consider whether or not a system which has been often described as one of the most inefficient that we still have in place today would have a better handle on the actual costs and expenses of this system. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions of Mr. Gallant? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. I'll call up Daryl Fuller, a late entrant on the witness list.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for adding me to the list. I got back a little late from my lunch in Eugene, so I appreciate you letting me sign in a little bit late. My name is Daryl Fuller. I'm here this afternoon in my capacity as president of the Oregon Small Business Coalition. It's a coalition of organizations representing primarily retail businesses in the state of Oregon. One of the previous witnesses who testified against the bills talked about the government not having a place in setting the fees or determining what the fees ought to be in this sort of arrangement. And part of me wanted to jump up and just cheer him on, because I just spent the last 4 years negotiating with the Attorney General's office to permit car dealers who process paperwork on behalf of our customers to increase a fee that we have from $35 to $50. So it took us about 4 years to get a $15 increase in a fee, while the bar apparently has a position that there should be no regulation of fees at all when it comes to attorneys. The reality is the state has a position of governing fees that businesses charge customers up and down the alphabet. I can scarcely think of businesses that don't have some sort of schedule or fee or somehow is regulated in how they go about doing their business and the fees that they are allowed to charge. A couple of examples come immediately to mind. There's a bill that was being heard last week. I'm not sure what the fate of the legislation will be, where they want to be able to when an emergency is declared, prohibit what they're calling price gouging on certain items, whether it's gasoline or home repairs, and when we have a state of emergency. where the state would come in and determine in the marketplace what is or isn't an appropriate price for a product under certain circumstances. Now, those are products that, when there isn't a state of emergency, the marketplace determines what the price is, but under certain circumstances, they want to be in a position of setting what the fee is. It seems to me that the entrance into the legal world requires you, in most cases, to have an attorney. You certainly can represent yourself if you want to, but anybody who really wants to be successful in the legal system has to have an attorney. And if you're a lower-income individual and you don't have the money to pay an attorney on retainer, and your only option for getting an attorney is to get one on a contingency basis, you are really at the mercy of the attorney to determine what their fee is going to be. You're really not in a position to negotiate, it seems to me. What this reminds me the most of over the last couple of sessions in watching legislation is the legislation that's coming through that has to do with payday loans, where there are people that have a significant interest, they believe, in saying the state of Oregon, when it comes to loans over a short period of time that are primarily given to low-income people, that it is somehow unconscionable for these private businesses to charge interest rates over a short period of time, which if expanded over the course of a normal loan or 1 year or would be an enormous interest rate, and that the state of Oregon somehow ought to clamp down on the amount of interest that they can charge in those short-term loans. It seems to me that the same logic for the people that advance that kind of legislation would fit very well in a contingency fee basis, where they indicate that with mostly low-income people that are going to attorneys that charge on a contingency basis, that the state ought to have an interest in making sure that the fees that are charged are not outrageous or outside of what would be considered reasonable for an attorney to charge for the fees that they provide. And with that, I'll be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you. Questions to the witness. Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fuller, I guess I'm not looking at this as a typical fee. This is, to me, seems much more like a salary for the attorney as opposed to a typical kind of fee. So I'm just wondering if there, you know, is there, do you know of any kind of limit that a CEO of any corporation is put on his or her salary per year based upon whether or not the company is profitable or unprofitable that year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, I'm not aware of any. I know that there are at least efforts, whether any of them are successful or not, because I don't follow federal legislation too much, where a corporate CEO's salary at some point is no longer deductible as a salary, as a business expense, because it's considered to be too much. And again, whether that's a proposal or whether that's actually in statute or not, I'm not sure. Certainly the shareholders of a corporation have the ability to govern the amount of money that the president, the CEO, and the other directors of a corporation have. We have situations where we govern people based on how much they get paid all the time. And if you follow the baseball argument we've had over the last few years, last few sessions, it's always been discussion of an income tax just on people over a certain income, so your taxing just the baseball players. So I think there are circumstances where we govern people based on their salary or how much they make. So I don't think there's the specific answer, I think, is no, but I think there are enough examples of situations that are similar to say that it's not unusual for the state to take an interest in these sort of issues.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative McPherson.
Mr. Fuller, I was interested by the analogy you drew to the payday loans, and that reminded me of a communication I had from a constituent who was complaining about the situation on payday loans and car title loans, and I think, in fact, it was car title loans that had affected a family member of theirs. That was an adult son had been pulled into an arrangement that was a loan, the terms of which turned out to be really quite overreaching. And that, in that case, the family of the affected consumer was advocating for the need for the legislation. Kind of drawing that analogy over here, do we have anybody from the consumer community, that is, people who are entering into contingency fee arrangements, or their close relations who are pressing for this change? Or is this coming from people who don't have the consumer's interests in mind?
Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson, I don't have that information in that I'm not an attorney. I don't represent attorneys or their clients. I represent an organization of small businesses, and as I indicated this morning when I testified previously, our interest is
very much in trying to keep the cost of litigation down, not so much the cost necessarily of litigation that's successful, but the environment that discourages businesses from going to court and proving that they're not doing things wrong, because it's so much less expensive to simply settle out of court, because that's faster and cheaper. So I'm here on behalf of the Small Business Coalition, on behalf of a number of these measures on a whole, because they have the potential of reducing an atmosphere that really allows attorneys to force businesses into out-of-court settlements on issues where the business believes that they ultimately could prevail. And the attractiveness of filing contingency fee cases for attorneys, their willingness to take those kind of cases is based on their profit motive. And lawyers are businessmen too, obviously. They have a profit motive, just like everybody else does. And to the degree that reducing the profit motive and the hours, the dollars per hour, if you will, that an attorney can get for these kind of fees, if it reduces the number of claims that are filed out there, that is what is our interest in this case. So you're asking the wrong person.
Yeah, I think you described very accurately what your perspective, which is not on behalf of the consumers, it's those who are paying the judgments if they get to that point.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that's correct. And if I represented myself as a consumer representative, then I apologize. That was not my intent.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? If not, appreciate your testimony. Thank you. I said a minute ago we were going to proceed with House Bill 2746. When I looked at the witness list of House Bill 3211, I saw it's, with one exception, it's exactly the same. Mm-hmm. The bills are very, very close together, so I'd like to consider all of your testimony with respect to each of these bills. And with that, I come up with one more proponent. It looks like Russ, and I'm going to hope I'm right by saying Walker. I'm wrong. You can correct me. Thank you. Please come forward.
Chairman Ackerman and members of the committee, my name is Russ Walker. I represent Freedom Works and Citizens for Sound Economy. We're a grassroots organization. Headquartered in Washington, D.C., with offices here in Oregon. We represent about 30,000 Oregonians. We're supportive of both of these bills, 2744 and, of course, 2746 and 3211. We're supportive of them primarily because, from our perspective, we look at this as a consumer protection issue. The big problem in the system today is that, and one of the reasons we support putting these types of controls on contingency fees is we believe that the consumer, the person who is harmed, is not served under the current environment. The current environment is a self-regulating environment, and unfortunately we don't believe it's being regulated very well by the Bar Association. So we support tighter regulations by the state on wages. We'd be supportive of either version. If you notice, our version, 3211 is a $500 limit per hour on personal injury and death. But we'd be supportive of percentage as well. The key, and what we're trying to accomplish, is we're trying to put some limitation on what ends up occurring, whether it's the class actions, where I think the average hourly wage is roughly $1,200 per hour. But in many cases, when it comes to tobacco and asbestos lawsuits, you're looking at upwards of $30,000 an hour being billed. I think the average person finds that very offensive. And in answer to your question, Representative McPherson, I think if you poll this, and it has been polled many times, in Oregon and around the country, what we find every time we poll is that Americans and Oregonians alike are overwhelmingly in support of capping contingency fees, putting some sort of controls on the contingency fees that can be charged. And in answer to your question, Representative Worth, I think that when it comes to the marketplace, the legal profession operates outside of a traditional market. They do not have the same pressures bearing on them as a market would if you were selling, say, Slurpees at 7-Elevens. A good example of this is, you know, a CEO in the marketplace, he has to answer to a board of directors, he has to answer to shareholders, he has to answer to the consumer by selling a product that is actually successful in the marketplace. Unfortunately, in the legal world, it's a self-regulated monopoly, if you will, by the Bar Association. I can't enter the legal world tomorrow and start practicing law. Not that I'd want to, but I can't. You can't either, and no one else can unless they have passed the bar exam and attended law school. So it is a self-regulating monopoly that excludes kind of some of the forces that the normal marketplace operates under. And therefore, what happens in those types of environments is frequently consumers end up paying more for the product than they would in a natural marketplace. A good example of this is if you look at the statistics, what you'll see when it comes to attorneys' wages is they've increased since 1960 by, I think it's almost 1,400%. And that's inflation-adjusted dollars. So those are real dollars. So our big concern is we share the same concerns that all of those who have testified in favor of this, but our big concern is not just for the consumer and making sure that the consumer gets the most, the person that is harmed receives the most benefit from the system, but also reducing what we like to call a litigation tax. It's the ability of the legal profession to seek to kind of roll the dice, and what ends up happening, unfortunately, is if they can raise the contingency fees on successful cases, it helps make it possible for them to run more cases that are unsuccessful, and take chances with cases that they may know are a long shot. We want to limit that. As an organization, we believe that every single lawsuit that's settled out of court because the business owner does not want to incur the huge cost of taking it all the way to the court system is what we call a litigation tax, and it gets passed on the consumer. The cost of litigation, the average consumer today is roughly about $800 per person in this country. How much of that is frivolous, I don't know. How much of that is good? We don't want to limit people's access to the courts. We want to make sure they have access, but we also want to reduce the caseload in the courts, making it possible for people to be remedied quicker, who deserve to be remedied. So with that, I'll go ahead and close, and we'll be testifying on some other bills too, but I'll answer any questions you have.
All right, we'll take questions now from the committee. Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understand, Citizens for Sound Economy is a libertarian organization, so I guess I'm not sure why then you'd be in favor of the bills which are really expanding government regulation. And I understand that you're testifying on behalf of the consumer, but again, we haven't heard from any consumers who are saying this is a problem.
Well, let me address your first question, Mr. Chair, Representative Worth. Let me address your first question about libertarian organizations supporting government regulation. If this was a market, we probably wouldn't support government regulation, but it's not a market, unfortunately. The legal profession is a self-regulating monopoly. And as such, it doesn't fall under the normal marketplace rules. So, unfortunately, if legal profession would be willing to open itself up, we would probably not have to do this. But the Bar Association keeps a tight rein on the legal profession. To the second question about consumers, We debated whether or not we should bring people into these hearings, knowing the tight schedule that we were dealing with here. And we've done this in other states, and we've done it here in Oregon, not on tort reform in Oregon, but in other states we've done it on tort reform in Texas, Florida, and Alabama. And we may do that in the future, but we knew that the time constraints made it difficult for us to bring people in to testify, and that's the reason we didn't.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, you may.
Regarding the self-regulating monopoly, I'd be interested in hearing, you know, what your other examples, because I would think the medical profession would be, if you were talking about just licensing, and I think maybe, you know, there's better ways of going about that. But I'm curious what you said about bringing in your consumers. Do you know of many cases personally that would be considered unreasonable according to this legislation?
Well, it depends on which piece of tort form we're talking about. But contingency fees, I mean, I think Mr. Mannix's comments about contingencies is probably pretty accurate. Most people, they're seeking remedy. They don't complain about the contingency fees, especially if they've gotten some sort of remedy. And unfortunately, those who have the least control over it are the lowest income Oregonians. They have the least control over who they choose, and they tend to agree with what's offered to them. It depends. We have a lot of our members are concerned with different issues related to tort reform, whether it's using sound science in courts, which we've filed a bill on that through Representative Thatcher, or whether it's limiting class action lawsuits, or whether it's... But it's kind of hard, you know, when you visit with folks and we bring people in to testify, each of them has a different angle that they take and different things they're concerned with. And I'm sure... There are some of our members who would come testify just specifically to contingency fees, but I can't say for sure about that. But I know that they're concerned with all the different issues.
So I guess what I'm asking is do you know of any cases that where you would think the fee was excessive or that would fall under these parameters? And yes. Just out of curiosity, what would you consider an excessive fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, the tobacco. Asbestos attorneys making $30,000 a year, an hour, is pretty excessive. That's the average fee of $1,200 per hour for class action attorneys. That's all well documented. I think those are excessive, and I think most Oregonians would find those excessive and quite frankly offensive, because those costs get passed on to consumers. In the case of tobacco, it's passed on to people who are addicted to a substance. How much does it help them that an attorney wins a huge case against the tobacco industry and makes $30,000 an hour? How does that help the guy who's smoking a pack of cigarettes? I think those costs get passed on to them in one form or another, and that does not help the consumer. But I think the best way to look at it, the best way you can get that information, Representative Worth, is, Mr. Chairman, is through, if you just look at the polls, and there's lots of polls that have been published on these issues. And I think that'll give you a clear picture of where Oregonians are on contingency fees.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, if I can't resist it. Mr. Rocker, the definition of a monopoly is when there's one provider of a service, and for anybody who's watched daytime television, which I thankfully haven't watched very much of, or has turned to the A section in the telephone book, you know that there's vigorous competition among attorneys to bring in business. Now, but here's my question. If your allegation, and I think this is what you mean, is that there's price fixing going on, not that there's only one provider of the service, and if that's the case, then why don't you pursue a remedy against price fixing if you think that there's not a vigorous competition over price going on?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, we could, if you'd like, I can address that, but we could probably have a philosophical discussion about the legal profession and our opinions as an organization about the legal profession and how it doesn't actually represent a market because it's essentially a regulatory agency, if you will, that's not a government agency. It's a regulatory body. Through its actions, it sets regulation that hampers the marketplace or keeps the free market from occurring, from growing and occurring. You do that every time a lawsuit is successful, it alters the marketplace in some way or another. So, from our definition, we've called the current legal position, the current legal industry a self-regulating monopoly, but you can choose to look at it how you want, but essentially it's controlled by one entity, the American Bar Association, and nobody enters that marketplace without being accepted by the American Bar Association, and that's what we mean by a monopoly. One entity controls it, one entity decides, what is said and done within that marketplace.
Well, I'll pursue another question, but as a member of the bar, but certainly not part of any any monolith that's controlling legal pricing, I have to say I don't see the world that same way.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson.
That could start the philosophical debate.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead, I'll let you conclude.
Thank you.
No, if I stay here, you might be some more questions.
Okay.
Any other questions? Let me just ask one. Would you favor any legislative control of insurance defense costs, such as competitive bidding by insurance companies to hire counsel to take cases? Would you go that far in wanting to examine and control the financing mechanisms of legal fees?
Mr. Chairman, no, we would not.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I believe we have three witnesses left on these two bills. Jeff Foote, Linda McCatherine, is it? Thank you. And Bill Syme, S-I-M-E. Do three folks like to come forward?
And with the committee's indulgence, would to permit Ms. McCatherine's mother to sit with her to assist?
Oh, yeah, no problem. Thank Welcome you. To the committee, subcommittee. Mr. Syme, you want to come forward? Mr. Syme, why don't you come forward, too? There's room for four.
Thank you.
You can proceed any way you wish.
Well, why don't I at least introduce these two here. I know Mr. Syme from cases we've handled together, but on the other side. So my name is Jeff Foote. I'm a lawyer from Portland, and it's been my honor for the last 30 years to represent individuals in personal injury, wrongful death, product liability, medical negligence lawsuits, the plaintiffs that the earlier gentleman had been talking about, the consumers. On my left is Linda McCatherine, who is my client in a case that we tried in 1997 from a 1995 accident. The case went to the Oregon Supreme Court. She waited over 6 years to finally recover in this case from the injury sustained in a rollover accident. And to her left is Patricia McCatherine, her mother, who through this ordeal stood by her side, was her nurse, her confidant, her mother, and our friend. So I think Linda, I don't have anything to say other than to introduce Linda and be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chairman, if the committee, can you hear me okay? Okay. I oppose this bill because Oregonians' ability to get legal representation and access to justice. By limiting attorney's fees, you limit an attorney's ability to represent people like me, and that's wrong. This bill limits the consumer's ability to hire an attorney, but it sets no limits on the other side's representation, and that's unfair. The other side can hire 20 attorneys, spend unlimited amounts on hiring lawyers. The consumers do not have this type of resources. We rely on the attorneys who believe in us. And Mr. Foote and I went through this case together as a team. I'd like to just share with you briefly what happened in my case. In May of 1995, I was injured in a motor vehicle accident. It was a Toyota 4Runner. And I was on my way home from the family reunion, and my cousin was driving, swerved around him to hit or to avoid a head-on collision. Upon returning into the lane, the vehicle rolled three times, and I was rendered a 3-4 quadriplegic. Fortunately, none of our children in the car were hurt by that accident. Like I said before, my attorney and I were in this together. I did not have the means to go out after Toyota all of myself. And fortunately, I was introduced to Mr. Foote, and he supported me through this. He sacrificed a lot on my behalf
took out a second mortgage on his home. Worked long hours, early in the morning, late into the night, and even the weekends. He gave up time with his wife, Cindy, and his children and grandchildren. And if this bill were to be enacted, there's no way Jeff would have been able to sustain his living and family and support the staff that he has in his law firm. In the end, Jeff put down his life and the life of his family and co-workers to help me out. He deserves adequate compensation for all he did over the 6 years it took to settle my case. He currently helps me with legal matters at no charge, and just out of the kindness of his heart. That's great advice on things, too. And I just ask you, please do not limit the amount of compensation that my attorney and all attorneys deserve.
Thank you. We'll take the other testimony before we open it to questions, okay? Okay. Next, Mr. Syme.
My name is Bill Syme, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Salem. I'm here as a volunteer member of the board of directors for the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. That's an organization of over 600 trial lawyers in the state who primarily represent individuals and companies in the defense of civil litigation. And so we represent small companies, larger companies, insurance companies in the defense of civil litigation. We are not the contingency fee lawyers. We are the lawyers who are paid on a per hour basis to defend these cases. And, you know, we very rarely get involved in matters of legislation, but we do monitor and track and offer input into those bills that we think have importance on issues such as civil procedure, rules of evidence, the operation of the courts, and most importantly, the right to trial by jury. And it may surprise some people to know that our organization has come before this committee and taken an opposition to these bills because we see that it does have a fundamental impact on the right to access to the court system. And also, I think it is an unfair impingement on the right to a jury trial because without competent representation, that right to a jury trial is really meaningless. This bill has been advanced as a piece of consumer legislation. I respectfully submit that if you look at the proponents of the bill, if you look at the other surrounding and related bills, that really the effect of this legislation, if it goes forward, is to limit the amount of cases that go to a jury trial and to build in a significant disincentive to plaintiff's lawyers to represent their clients through the jury trial. Most cases settle and don't go to trial, but there are many cases that it's reasonable minds can differ on, issues of liability or damages, and there's got to be that safety valve, there's got to be that right to a jury trial available to people if they cannot resolve their differences. And I wasn't expecting to take the lead on this or the point on this issue at all, but I just suffice to say that our organization want to go on the record in opposition to these bills, and I'm willing to answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you very much for your testimony, all of you. Questions from the committee? Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, would you have taken the case as complicated as Ms. McCatherine's had this proposal been in place, the law with the caps on the contingency fees?
I couldn't have. A lot of the proponents are focused on the fee issue. Understand that in addition to the fee issue, there are substantial out-of-pocket costs, which I do recognize are allowed to be part of the that they're in this bill that we can recover those. But someone like Linda or 99% of the clients I represent can't afford those costs. So we as lawyers are allowed under our system to advance those costs. So understand we're taking money that we've paid taxes on. This is essentially the income that goes to our families, and we're essentially investing it in these cases. In a case like Linda McCatherine's case, we're talking several hundred thousand dollars. It would have been economic disaster for myself or any lawyer to take that case unless the lawyer was taking it with the idea that he or she would simply go to Toyota and say, I want to settle this case for whatever I can get. And in that case, Ms. McCatherine would not have been well served.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes, ma'am.
And just out of curiosity, both you and Mr. Simon, have you had any clients that you've represented on a contingency fee basis complain about the amount that you, once it was, once the verdict had come in, whether or not that was an excessive fee?
I don't know that a client has ever used the term excessive fee. I've had discussions with clients, certainly, as you would in any business. We generally worked it out, and as the lawyers on the committee know, if there is a dispute, if it rises to the level of dispute, the Oregon State Bar has a fee resolution process. I've never been to it, so I don't know how it works. I believe it's an arbitration, so that a client who is unhappy with the fee can go that route. But yes, I've had clients have been concerned about fees. We've sat down and talked about them, and we've always been able to resolve it.
Further questions from the committee? Yes, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Foote, is there competition among plaintiff's lawyers or working on a contingency fee, and does that competition include over the percentages of recovery?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. There. I don't know if you recall, but years ago when I started practicing, the Oregon State Bar had a suggested fee schedule. And Representative Ackerman is nodding his head because he recalls that. I can't recall how long ago it was that was abolished because of the necessity for competition. And I will tell you that it's unusual when a client calls that maybe hasn't checked with one or two other lawyers, and there is competition both on the percentage, all aspects of it. And that's not just locally. I mean, many of the cases I handle in other states working with local lawyers because of this subspecialty I seem to have developed with Toyota and other manufacturers. And there is competition nationally as well. To suggest there's not would be just not understanding the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? If not, you're excused, and thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Anyone else that wishes to testify on House Bill 2746 or 3211? Now is your time to let me know before I close the public hearings on each of those bills. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2746 and 3211. We're going into our second block of bills, and we're about 15 minutes ahead of ourselves. I appreciate the fact that we are working our schedule relatively well today. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3207 and 3336 and invite Mr. Mannix and Ms. Ironman to take this one to come forward. And counsel will explain each of these bills, and each of the witnesses will have a five-minute overview before we get into the public testimony. Counsel?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bills 3207 and 3336 are essentially the same. They provide that upon an offer of expert scientific evidence at trial, a court must first determine whether the theory or technique supporting the offered evidence is based on scientifically valid principles and is pertinent. They both set forth specific factors that the court must use to determine whether the theory or technique is based on scientifically valid principles. These bills allow the courts to seek the assistance of its own expert for the purposes of evaluating certain evidence. They provide that a witness may not testify about scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge if the compensation of the witness is contingent on the outcome of the proceeding.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mannix.
Good afternoon again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Mannix. I'm an attorney in Salem, and I'm testifying today as the project manager for the Oregon Litigation Fairness Project. As to House Bill 3207 and House Bill 3336, We have submitted a packet of information, which I submitted this morning, and I asked that it be made a part of the record for all the bills. That packet of information includes what I call talking points on both of these bills, as well as a simple statement of the distinctions between the two bills, which again is in the packet, but I'll go over it briefly. The two bills are almost identical. They are not quite identical. House Bill 3207 is clear on page 1, line 13, when it states that all factors that are listed shall be considered. In case there's any fudge consideration about whether or not all factors are supposed to be considered, 3207 is clear and states that. Then on page 1, line 24 of each bill, you'll see that House Bill 3207 relates to expert scientific evidence offered at any stage of a case. House Bill 3336 language suggests that it's limited in its application to scientific evidence offered at trial. So those are two considerations to take into mind in looking at the bills. Conceptually, this has to do with the use of scientific evidence and the concern that has developed in terms of what I'll call the popular phrase is junk science. What kind of science do you get to bring into litigation? At the outset of the discussion, I would like to emphasize this is meant to be limited to the civil side and civil proceedings. I've had some concern expressed about this flowing over to the criminal justice system, where the standards are different, and of course the burden of proof in a criminal proceeding is beyond a reasonable doubt. Criminal justice system has developed its own standards, and parenthetically, I had those concerns expressed today, and of course, we're really intending to address the civil justice system, not the criminal justice system with this legislation. The idea is to develop some standards and place them in the statutes, which cut both ways. They apply both to the plaintiff's side as well as the defense side. And I think that's important because both sides need to be able to determine in advance what their risks are, what the facts are, and what kind of scientific evidence is being posed. And I do think that this legislation provides us with strong standards, which the courts can then utilize to weigh the scientific evidence which is being proposed by one side or the other, proffered by one side or the other in civil litigation. I commend it to your consideration, and I certainly offer full support to the legislation.
Thank you, Ms. Mannix. Ms. Harmon.
Thank you, Chairman Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Linda Ironman. I'm a lawyer from Portland. I've been practicing for 30 years. I'm a former president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and currently sit on the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors. I'm here today as a representative of the Oregon Trial Lawyers to oppose these bills. And I also, as a practicing lawyer and someone who has represented the plaintiff in the one scientific evidence civil case that has gotten to the Oregon Supreme Court, I know this area of law pretty well, so I hope that I can help you out if you have questions. The first thing that I would like to make clear, Mr. Mannix says that these bills are addressing only civil litigation. Well, there is no way that a change in the Oregon Evidence Code can affect only tort bills. The Oregon Evidence Code, which includes Rule 702, which this bill amends, governs the admissibility of expert testimony in every case that comes into court. The vast majority of scientific evidence that is offered in cases in Oregon is offered by criminal prosecutors in it's evidence that has been developed by the police and crime labs. With the one exception of the case that I handled, all of the scientific evidence cases that have reached the Oregon Supreme Court have been criminal cases. They involve the admissibility of polygraph or lie detector evidence, the admissibility of sealed sobriety tests that police officers conduct in drunk driving investigations, and the admissibility of a certain type of DNA evidence in a murder case. So if the purpose of this bill is to tighten the rules that govern the admissibility of scientific evidence, the practical effect will be to make it more difficult for the state of Oregon to convict people who are charged with serious crimes. I'm not in favor of that myself, and I do think that the criminal law subcommittee would be interested in this bill. I also want to point out that this bill is not the same as the federal rule 702, so the effort here is not to bring Oregon law in compliance with federal law. As far as I can tell, the two bills that are offered are their own unique bills. I know of no other state that is being that this is being modeled after. On the merits of the bills, if you read the bills carefully, you'll see that they mandate a hearing on any case in which scientific evidence is offered, and that will create a tremendous burden on the courts. It will mean that in every traffic case where the police officer has used radar to clock a driver's speed, there will need to be a preliminary hearing. In drunk driving cases where the breathalyzer has been offered as evidence, we'll need to have a preliminary hearing. We'll need to have a hearing in burglary cases where fingerprint evidence is being offered. In business cases where an expert is relying on statistics or some sort of computer analysis to compute financial or business losses, we'll have to have a hearing. And the Supreme Court has held that medicine is a science. And therefore, in every case where a doctor comes to court to testify about the cause of his patient's injury, we'll have to have a preliminary hearing. So the mandatory nature of this bill is very time-consuming for the courts, very expensive for the parties, because more witnesses will be needed. Prosecutors will actually not be able to bring in only the police officers, but will have to bring in those who can support the actual workings of a breathalyzer, for example. And it's really unnecessary, because from the examples I've given, you can see that most scientific evidence that is offered is based on conventional science, and really it's admitted in cases without any objection. A second problem with this bill, in addition to the mandatory nature of it, is that we really already have a very useful functioning system in Oregon for screening scientific evidence. It's based on the current rules of evidence that we have, and the system's working well. Current law requires that a court screen scientific evidence whenever a party to the case asks the court to do it, which is the way the adversary system works. The evidence is screened using really four evidence rules. It's screened for relevance under evidence rule 401. It's screened for helpfulness under evidence rule 702. It's screened for whether the expert has an adequate basis for what he or she says under evidence rule 703. And it's screened for whether the probative value of the evidence is outweighed by some other factors, such as confusion of the issues, misleading the jury, or the danger of unfair prejudice. That's our existing screening process, and it works well. The main difference between the way that the screening is done under current law and the way that it would be done under this bill is that current law recognizes the need for the analysis to be flexible. there's no list of factors that will work in every case. Science is a multidisciplined field, and what will work for a researcher in a laboratory will not necessarily work for a doctor seeing a patient in an office or a surgeon in an operating room. Current Oregon law makes clear that the factors like the ones that are listed in the bill are useful in certain disciplines, but if you're looking at other disciplines, then you have to look at the factors that apply. It's a flexible approach, it's a sensible approach, and it seems to be working very well. Actually, Oregon is somewhat of a model around the country for taking this sensible approach to the admissibility of scientific evidence.
Ms. Ryman, you're just a little bit over your 5 minutes, so do you want to summarize your testimony? We can come back and either call you or call Mr. Mannix back as witnesses at the end.
Thank you. Yes, actually, I am the opposition here, so I'm sorry if I didn't understand the rules.
Yeah, each was to get 5 minutes for an overview, and if you want to come back and testify, I'll let you testify at the last and give Mr. Mannix the same opportunity.
Okay, there are other provisions that are in the bill, as counsel stated, and I'll save any remarks about those until later.
Okay. Questions of the committee of these two panelists? Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I read the one component I don't think either of you addressed, but the aspect of the proposal that says provides that an expert may not testify about scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge if his or her compensation is contingent on the outcome of the proceedings. So as I understand, is it true that as long as a client had the financial means then to compensate any expert witness up front, then that would be allowed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, I discern that the question is directed to me, so I'll respond at the outset, and perhaps Ms. Ironman will also want to respond. Absolutely. No expert witness should ever be invested in the results of a proceeding. And that is one area of this legislation that I think really ought to be carefully examined. I've not addressed it in my opening remarks. But the fact is, we heard the earlier discussion about contingent fees and costs being advanced by attorneys. One of the costs that attorneys do advance is the cost of putting together expert witness testimony. Frankly, a witness's testimony will be compromised on cross-examination in any event if they're testifying with a fee contingent on the result of the case. Now, it seems to me that there's no problem, as far as I'm concerned, from a public policy perspective, making it clear that an expert witness should be testifying from that person's expertise and position as an expert, should be compensated for their testimony, but should not be compensated based on whether or not their side wins or loses, whether it's in the civil or the criminal sector. And we'll have a separate discussion later about the criminal sector versus the civil sector.
Further questions for the committee?
I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair. So I'm trying to get a sense of, what kind of cases are typically the clients who aren't able to pay their expert witnesses up front and who do rely on this outcome basis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, I'm going to have to hear from others about that, because as far as I'm concerned, that was simply a principle that we thought should be in the legislation. There should be a legislative standard that you should never do that, period. And if there's anyone that wants to justify doing it, I'd like to hear from them.
Thank you. Chairman,
yes,
Ackerman, may I speak to that point?
You may.
It really doesn't happen in Oregon, or it shouldn't happen, that experts are compensated on a contingent fee basis, because we lawyers have ethics rules that prohibit that. For many, many years, we've had Disciplinary Rule 7-109, subsection C, which prohibits a lawyer from paying compensation to any witness on a contingent on the outcome of the case. And we have new rules of professional response, of professional conduct, that were just adopted, and that has the same prohibition in Rule 3.4, subsection B.
Thank you. Further questions? Okay, I'll, yes, counsel.
I just had a quick question, I guess, for either of you. I'm just kind of curious how specifically this changes current law, and specifically I want to focus on the factors that courts must look to. Ms. Araman, I know you testified to this a little bit, saying that different areas of science would mean looking at different factors. So if a judge looks at a factor and it's irrelevant to that science, I mean, the judge would then, you could argue that the judge looked at that factor and it was irrelevant. So I guess my point would be, putting this down in statute, are there any new factors that this law is putting forth that are not currently in Oregon law, whether I assume they're mostly in case law, that judges are required to look to, and will this change the standard on how judges look to these factors? The base of my question, how will this change existing law?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Oregon Evidence Code was, the expert testimony rules, as I recall, were enacted in about 1981. And OEC 702 and 703 go back that far, and as I understand it, they've not been updated since that time. The commentary for Oregon Evidence Code 702 specifically said the Legislative Assembly leaves for judicial discretion the standard to be used in determining the admissibility of novel scientific evidence. That's what the commentary said. So the mother lode, so to speak, as to where we start from is, well, it's up to judicial discretion. There have been court cases that have come down over the years which have discussed this. As Ms. Ironman pointed out, they're usually in the criminal justice context. This would establish legislative standards that the court must consider. I do want to emphasize that the standards say the court must consider those factors. It doesn't say it is bound by any one of them, and it really relates, when you read it, what ought to be common sense standards for testing the validity of scientific testimony. This is an effort to have the legislature establish a listing of the standards that must be considered. It doesn't exclude the courts from considering additional factors that are not listed, and it puts everything in one place with clear legislative direction, as opposed to the current system, which is pretty much left up to judicial discretion and case law.
Okay, any further questions? I want to move this on. We have about seven more witnesses. I want to get out of here by five.
I just have a quick question, Mr.
All right,
Mr.
go ahead.
Can you tell me, do any members of the judicial community have an opinion on these bills?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, they normally don't come by to express opinions on particular legislation unless it has some direct impact on the administration of the judicial system. At least that's been my understanding of the traditional practice with the judiciary, so they don't normally come in to testify on these kinds of things. They do occasionally, but it usually has to do with the administration of the justice system.
Just clarification, Mr. Chair. I guess what I was saying, you know, given that we're going to require them to have the expertise of like the known potential or potential rate of error in a technique and the existence of operational standards controlling techniques, operation, acceptance of theory or technique in relevant scientific community, since we're going to be requiring them, I imagine they would have an opinion on this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, they may have an opinion about it, and sometimes they choose to come by to express an opinion. In this case, these are requirements. If you're going to have an expert witness testifying at trial or in a legal proceeding, who's right there? And this basically says they should be able to address these issues, and the court should be able to consider the factors. And one would wonder why they should be considered an expert if they can't answer those kinds of questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions?
Chairman Eckerman, may I answer counsel's question or try to answer
yes,
this?
Yes.
It will change.
If you can, briefly.
I'll try to do
help.
It briefly. Each of the cases that have come before the court have been totally fact-based. And the analysis that the court has gone through is based on the record in that case and what evidence is there that supports the scientific validity of that particular type of scientific evidence. So our concern is that by putting factors into a statute, we can't possibly list all the factors that will apply to every type of science and every set of facts. And if we start to list them, we're going to leave some out. And it really is a case-by-case analysis that the court goes through in each case. And in the civil case that went to the Supreme Court, which involved silicone breast implants and clinical medicine, the court said that the scientific basis that should be looked at is differential diagnosis. That's something totally different than the research type of analysis that's listed in these factors. So it really is a fact-based, case-by-case analysis, and we'd like to leave it that way because it's working well.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to go down the list of the proponents and call them in the order that they signed up. And I'll start with Terry Witt. Representative Anderson wanted to be contacted in Hearing Room D. I don't know how we can do that. Oh, he's here. I'm sorry. Please come forward. And Russ Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before you start, I want to get the panel totally assembled up here so I know who I have. And keep in mind that we're trying to get out by 5, and I probably have another panel that I have to exhaust. So I'd appreciate your testimony and try not to be too repetitious.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members for hearing this bill. For the record, I'm Representative Gordon Anderson representing District 3. I am not an attorney, and I'm not a judge. In former life, I spent several years doing research in the medical field, biological science, and I came to the distinct impression that there are many different kinds of science. There's very excellent science that is based on evidence, and there's junk science. The evidence-based science generally is peer-reviewed. It takes voluminous information, culls it down into a very hard proof, or at least attempted proof for an hypothesis. Junk science, on the other hand, tends to be much more anecdotal, tends to be based, at least in my impression, on testimony that is not based in true fact, but oftentimes on emotion and anecdote. I mean, just give you an illustration. I think we've heard just recently, just a few minutes ago, that do you take that of a researcher versus a doctor? Well, you can take them both, but you have to base them on large samples over a long period of time, or either longitudinal or vertical type of studies, and then you do come down to a pretty good basis of what's true and what isn't true. If you're basing it only on the anecdote of a doctor who comes in and says, well, I have 3 patients and this happened, I wouldn't want to accept that in court as much as I'd like to say, here's 15 different articles covering 3,000 patients that prove this point. So I think you can distinguish, and the court can easily distinguish over a period of time. Another illustration, we were told that traffic radar might be questioned. No, I think the courts are wise enough to say in some cases this has been an accepted technique. We can rely on it. It's been proven. Therefore, we don't need to delve into each and every case, but rather we just take the overall as being good science. The reason I brought this bill, and it's interesting, it wasn't until several weeks ago I realized that there were 3 of these bills, all pretty much the exact wording within 1 or 2 words. I had the experience of going to a national conference and heard voluminous testimony from many different states saying we need to standardize the kind of science that's being introduced. And so this bill that I've introduced is essentially a model bill. It went to LC, as you might well imagine. It came out a little bit differently, but it came out exactly the same as Senator Atkinson's bill and also Representative Thatcher's bill. I am more than willing to merge my bill with either of the others or to combine them in a way that will be the most efficient, but I do think the premise of the bills is good and that we need to move forward and help testimony in the courts be much more accurate. So in that sense, I'm going to leave the technical testimony to those who follow me and those who have already proceeded, and I encourage you to consider this bill very strongly, and I hope you will pass it to the floor.
Thank you. Next witness.
Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We support both House Bill 3207 and 3336. I'll keep my comments very brief. I also am not a lawyer, and I'm focusing primarily on the civil side of this issue. I don't deal in the criminal element, and I would hate to see the criminal element be given any get-out-of-jail-free cards, so to speak. But what we do see happening is a real proliferation of citizen lawsuits through several of the environmental acts, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, FIFRA, which regulates pesticides. And we are seeing a proliferation of junk science, where these individuals or groups are filing suits for injunctive relief against natural resource businesses, and the evidence that they bring forth is, in fact, junk science. And we get into a situation where we have what we know now call dueling scientists, where you line up scientists on both sides of an issue. And unfortunately, if you have a PhD after your name, that's typically all that counts in terms of being added to the number. We don't look to see whether one of the PhDs might be in history and the other PhD might be in molecular toxicology, particularly if the subject matter is environmental toxicology. So I would just like to say that the system, I think, is broke, and we need to do something to get it back in whack so that we can stop situations where the courts are defining science that ultimately winds up regulating our businesses in a way that does not meet with the facts and the laws of science. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Walker?
Chairman Ackerman and members of the committee, we are supportive of 3207 and 3336. There's really only one difference, and that's how 3207 encompasses all evidence through the entire life of the court case, from the beginning to the end. I think the difference is the word all, and I think Mr. Mannix spoke to that. So I won't go any further than that unless you have questions. We see this as a common sense thing. We're very concerned about the amount of junk science that's being used in the courts. I can remember in high school when I learned how to determine the difference between junk science and real science. And I think that's what this bill does. It lays out the minimal requirements we should be asking the expert witnesses to provide us, to prove that the science that they're giving us is real science versus something that hasn't been peer-reviewed, something that hasn't been tested, something that hasn't been put through that scientific method. That's all we're asking for. We're asking for a minimal standard here. And I don't think it's too much to ask, especially when you're talking about the kind of dollars involved in the economy and how much damage frivolous suits using junk science can bring to the economy in general. And I'll go ahead and just close my testimony there. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Do we have questions from the committee? Yes, Chair Krieger.
Chair Ackerman, I can't remember, Terry, if you were at a forestry board meeting some years ago. I can recall then state forester Brown gave us a book called Science 101 by Dr. Paul Adams. And basically, committee, and those of you who are here, it's a great thing. I read part of it today, in fact. I review it frequently. But what it is, it's a way of analyzing for commissions and boards and policymakers as to the accuracy of science, whether it's personal opinion, agenda-driven, or biased. I probably should get you all a copy of it because it's rampant, especially in the natural resource arena. That's where it's being abused to the greatest extent. People who have something to gain by what they tell boards and commissions, whether it be the Forestry Board, Department of Fish and Wildlife, when these people are actually seeking guidance to do right, they have to take out this personal opinion and stuff that's in the scientific literature. And here again, you do have this I have two scientists in the same field looking at the same information and coming to two different conclusions. And that is routine, depending on who's paying the bill. That's what it amounts to. I will, Mr. Chair, furnish that for the committee members. I think you need to have it.
Okay. Further statements from the committee or questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony. I'll call up the next panel as I have it on the witness list. Leigh Wilkerson. And John Ledger. I think you were the last two proponents I have, so please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ray Wilkerson. I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I appreciate this opportunity to speak in support, conceptually at least, of House Bill 3336. There may be some practical implications to the bill in terms of how a court would actually administer it that are beyond my ability to determine accurately at the moment, but the concept is certainly meritorious. One of the previous witnesses mentioned the natural resource side of this issue, and clearly there are numerous examples in recent history here in the state of Oregon of litigation based largely on a scientific opinion and testimony that has had profound impacts on basically the whole history of this state. Just a few examples that I think most of us are familiar with. 15 years ago, the science, state of the science was that northern spotted owls required old-growth forests to survive. As a result of that, millions of acres of federal forest land were locked up as a result of a federal injunction initially. And that has had a tremendous impact on communities and people in this state. Now that science is not nearly as certain as it used to be. There's a lot more owls than they thought at the time, and they use habitat that is other than old growth. Marbled murrelets is another example, another species federally listed based on scientific opinion that there's something different about marbled murrelets in Oregon than the millions of marbled murrelets that live in British Columbia and Alaska. And as a result of that, here in Oregon, the Elliott State Forest is producing about half of the timber that it could produce if that bird was not on the endangered species list based on the scientific evidence that was presented. That scientific evidence is very questionable in a lot of people's minds now. One other example is 40 years ago, we were told we had to take all the down trees and logs and root rods out of streams that were in there because that blocked passage and the fish couldn't get up to the spawning grounds. Now it's just the opposite. Now the science is that stuff is good for the fish, so we're leaving behind tens of millions of dollars of timber alongside streams every year on private land in Oregon to compensate for the fact that all that wood that used to be there was taken out based on the science at the time. So I think there's seems to me the standards that are written into this bill to me seem like common sense. It ought to be a nonpartisan or a bipartisan issue. It isn't probably, but it ought to be. And one reason I say that is that former Governor Kitzhaber recently has proposed what he calls evidence-based review as a way of he thinks could be applied to disputes over natural resource management. And he is trying to get at the kinds of politicized and dueling expert kinds of scientific debates that have caused some of these disruptions in Oregon in recent years. And his theory is based on the more rigorous scientific analysis that applied to medical procedures, and he has experience at that. So it sounds very similar to what he would like to do too. There's something that totally unsatisfactory with how we deal with these things right now, and if it could be improved, I think we all would be better off. So thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries, and I will be very brief. I'd just like to echo what Mr. Wilkerson said. We often see, let me just back up a little bit. Over the last 10 years, we have seen a big increase in the number of lawsuits filed in the environmental areas. They used to be relatively rare, and they're absolutely common now. And generally, if you're getting a significant size permit of one type or another, you can almost expect to be sued. So this has really become more and more important to our members over time. And they do get into situations of dueling scientists, which is always frustrating. The other piece that I just want to talk about briefly is the whole issue of standards and scientific proof has become much more speculative in the last 5 or 6 years. We have a lot of low-hanging fruit, and we're now looking at extremely, extremely low levels that are set as standards and limits for extremely wide range of different substances. We're looking at things now that we're looking at 4 tablespoons, 4 teaspoons for 4 quadrillion tons of water. We're having standards set that cannot be measured. You actually have a limit that is below what can be measured. But mathematically, you could still get in trouble. So the whole issue and sensitivity of this, I think, has really gone up, especially when you're looking at things like fish and health issues, and it's just entered into just a broader and broader area of speculation. And so I think anything we can do that would try to put some more focus and some more quality on the type of issues that come up as science in the courtroom would be very valuable. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a biologist, actually, so I'm interested in this myself. The bill's interesting. I think it does have some things in that, you know, that need to be figured out. It uses the word theory, and a scientific theory is quite different from legal theory. It's means something completely different. But I think it's a good step in the right direction. I think it would be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee?
Okay.
You're excused. Thank you very much for participating this afternoon. Our last two witnesses are opponents of the bills, David Schmarbach and Kevin Nicely, is it? Or Neely? Please come forward.
Looks like just me, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I'll be very, very brief. For the record, Kevin Neely, Executive Assistant to Attorney General Hardy Myers. I'm here not on behalf of the Department of Justice, as usual. Rather, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The Oregon District Attorneys Association opposes these two bills, largely for the reasons that you heard Mrs. Eierman discuss. These bills would have a significant impact on the criminal lawsuits, in fact, criminal prosecutions, with which they are charged. As Mr. Mannix noted, it wasn't his intent to address the criminal side of the legal system. I think that the district attorneys would probably be not as opposed to this bill if there was a carve-out for the criminal prosecutions. And with that, I would try to answer any questions, but I'm not an attorney either, nor have I practiced prosecutorial law.
That makes you an expert.
Hardly.
Okay, questions for the committee? Fine, thank you. I might ask Ms. Eierman and Mr. Mannix to come back for a couple of minutes. We're just a little bit ahead of time, and I appreciate that from the other witnesses. Let me pose one question to you and then have you each make a brief summation. How is it possible in the world of expert testimony that we can have qualified experts come to different conclusions on the same topic?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's actually possible because we do finally turn to the jury, which is composed of lay people, as to represent the conscience of the community and the decision-making power of the community. And there are areas where legitimate doubt exists as to one theory versus another and how you prove that theory, how you apply science to the case. And yes, you can take that issue to a jury and they can make a determination as to when they look at the totality of the evidence and then they consider what the experts have to say, which way they go, one way or another. The reason why I would go along with the ODAA's concern about the criminal justice system is that they have developed a very careful structure through litigation as to standards that go to a jury in a different milieu where the prosecution is bound to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. All the defendant has to do is bring up a reasonable doubt. And we really thought about this legislation in the civil context, and so you are dealing with a different world. The short answer to the question, Mr. Chairman, is in many cases the vast majority of experts may be on one side or the other. On occasion, they may be in equal poise. But in either situation, it ought to be incumbent on the experts and those who are proposing their testimony to be able to take a look at these common sense standards and answer the question, how do these standards apply to your testimony?
Ms. Eierman?
Well, I really have two answers to that question, Chairman Ackerman. One is that the case law makes very clear that the courts are not allowed to look at the conclusions that the experts reach, but rather what they're evaluating is the methodology that the expert used to reach that conclusion. And as long as an expert is using a scientific valid methodology, then, you know, reasonable minds do differ. So it's really the methodology that is the focus in these evaluations. The reason I believe that experts reach different conclusions in court cases is that usually this is where there is some sort of new science that is being proposed, something that is not really well established, because once something is well established, there's no need to litigate anymore. The asbestos cases were the perfect example for that. Back in the 70s, when there were first lawsuits over asbestos exposure causing certain type of injury, it was very controversial whether asbestos could cause that. Now, 20 or 30 years later, there's no controversy on that subject at all. So most of the asbestos cases don't go to court anymore. So it all depends on where a particular science is in its life, too.
Thank you. Any more questions from the committee of these two witnesses? Good to have you back. Thank you for participating, and I'll excuse you at this time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other persons here to testify on House Bill 3336 or 3207?
May I finish my earlier testimony?
Well, no, I've closed the hearing right now. Yes, did I miss somebody?
I didn't sign up. I just had a comment on 3336 based on a question that was asked by the committee.
Okay, can I come forward and give us your name, please?
Sure. Very briefly for the record, Scott Berry with the Oregon Building Industry Association. I'd not planned on testifying this morning, but I did just want to comment very briefly. We have, I think, support for both bills, but specifically, I didn't hear much opposition to it on page 2 of House Bill 3336, the first line, a witness may not testify about scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge if compensation of the witness is contingent on the outcome of the proceedings. And we do have numerous cases where siding companies will travel around, they will testify about the horrible nature of the siding placed on a particular house. It may be an existing house, it may be something that's been on either a new house, excuse me, or an existing house. And then at the end of that trial or court case, that same siding company is the same siding company that goes out and resides the house. And they tend to make a fairly good living off doing that sort of thing. And so I'm not sure how that falls under the compensation or whether that would be affected by this bill, but it is definitely a problem with our industry.
Thank you. Questions of this witness? Okay, you're excused. I'm going to apologize to Ms. Harmon. You did tell me that you did have additional testimony, and I acted too fast. Why don't you come back one more time, and you can finish your testimony, then we'll conclude. I think we were not on the same track as what we were doing earlier. I'm sorry if I cut you off.
Thank you, Chairman Ackerman. Just briefly, on the issue of factors, one of the leading cases in Oregon is State versus O'Keefe, a criminal case, and there are actually 16 factors that are discussed in that case, 7 from an earlier Oregon case and I believe 9 from a federal case, or maybe the other way around, but it's very difficult to pick what factors should go into a statute when you have something as broad as the concept of science. On the other sections of the bill, just very briefly, subsection 3 is totally unnecessary because what it does is it parrots what is already in Evidence Rules 703 and 403. So the issues of out-of-court statements by experts and the prejudicial effect outweighing the probative value are already covered by current law. The last thing that the bill has is a sentence in there on court experts, giving the court the ability to obtain assistance from its own expert. The subject of court experts is really a very difficult one to get your arms around because there are a lot of questions, including who pays for the expert. That portion of the bill may have fiscal impact. And also, how does a court consult an expert within the bounds of the Constitution? So if there really is an interest on someone's part on the issue of court experts, I would suggest that the subject be sent perhaps to the Council on Court Procedures or the Bar's Practice and Procedure Committee for study, because it really is controversial. Thank you very much allowing me to complete my testimony.
I apologize again. Any further questions of this witness before we adjourn? Further testimony on either of these bills? Hearing none, I'll close the public hearing on House Bills 3207 and 3336. And see no further business before the committee. We are adjourned until 8:30 tomorrow morning.